I wouldn't want to be up against one in a situation like that.
Perhaps above all else, Matheson excels at the depiction of one man alone, locked in a desperate struggle against a force or forces bigger than himself. Here is the conclusion of Scott's battle with the bird that knocks him into a cellar prison. He stood up, flinging more snow at the bird, seeing the snow splatter off its dark, flaring beak. The bird flapped back. Scott turned and struggled a few more strides. Then the bird was on him again, wet wings pounding at his head. He slapped wildly at it and felt his hand strike the bony sides of its beak. It flew off again. Until, finally, cold and dripping, he stood with his back to the cellar window, hurling snow at the bird in the desperate hope that it would give up and he wouldn't have to jump into the imprisoning cellar. But the bird kept coming, diving at him, hovering before him, the sound of its wings like wet sheets flapping in a heavy wind. Suddenly, the jabbing beak was hammering at his skull, slashing skin, knocking him back against the house. He picked up snow and threw it, missing. The wings were still beating at his face. The beak gashed his face again. With a stricken cry, Scott whirled and leapt for the open square. He crawled across it dizzily. The leaping bird knocked him through. When the bird knocks Scott into the cellar, the man is 7 inches tall. Matheson has made it clear that the novel is, to a large extent, a simple comparison of the macrocosm and the microcosm, and his hero's 7 weeks in this lower world are a tiny capsule of experience which exactly mimes what he has already been through in a larger world. When he falls into the cellar, he is its king. He is able to exert his own human power over the environment with no real trouble. But as he continues to shrink, his power begins to wane once again, and the nemesis appears. The spider rushed at him across the shadowed sands, scrabbling wildly on his stalk-like legs. Its body was a giant, glossy egg that trembled blackly as it charged across the windless mounds, its wake a score of sand-trickling scratches. The spider was gaining on him. Its pulsing egg of a body perched on running legs, an egg whose yolk swam with killing poisons. He raced on, breathless, terror in his veins. In Matheson's view, macrocosm and microcosm are terms which are ultimately interchangeable, and all of Scott's problems throughout the shrinking process become symbolized in the Black Widow Spider, which also shares Scott's cellar world. When Scott discovers the one thing in his life which has not shrunk, his ability to think and plan, he also discovers a source of power which is immutable no matter which cosm it happens to exist in. His escape from a cellar, which Matheson succeeds in making as strange and frightening as any alien world, follows, and his final heartening discovery, that to nature there was no zero, and that there is a place where the macrocosm and the microcosm eventually meet. The Shrinking Man can be read simply enough as a great adventure story. It is certainly one of that select handful that I have given to people, envying them the experience of the first reading. Others would include Bloch's The Scarf, Tolkien's The Hobbit, Bertrand Rucher's Feral. But there's more going on in Matheson's novel than just adventure, a kind of surreal outward-bound program for little people. On a more thoughtful level, it is a short novel which deals in a thought-provoking way with concepts of power, power lost and power found. Let me pull back from the Matheson book briefly. Like Douglas MacArthur, I shall return, and make the following wild statement. All fantasy fiction is essentially about the concept of power. Great fantasy fiction is about people who find it at great cost, or lose it tragically. Mediocre fantasy fiction is about people who have it and never lose it, but simply wield it. Mediocre fantasy fiction generally appeals to people who feel a decided shortage of power in their own lives and obtain a vicarious shot of it by reading stories of strong-thewed barbarians, whose extraordinary prowess at fighting is only excelled by their extraordinary prowess at fucking. In these stories, we are apt to encounter a 7-foot-tall hero fighting his way up the alabaster stairs of some ruined temple, a flashing sword in one hand and a scantily clad beauty lolling over his free arm. This sort of fiction, commonly called sword and sorcery by its fans, is not fantasy at its lowest, but it still has a pretty tacky feel.
Mostly it's the Hardy Boys, dressed up in animal skins and rated R, and with cover art by Jeff Jones, as likely as not. Sword and sorcery novels and stories are tales of power for the powerless. The fellow who is afraid of being rousted by those young punks who hang around his bus stop can go home at night and imagine himself wielding a sword, his potbelly miraculously gone, his slack muscles magically transmuted into those iron thews which have been sung and storied in the pulps for the last 50 years. The only writer who really got away with this sort of stuff was Robert E. Howard, a peculiar genius who lived and died in rural Texas. Howard committed suicide as his mother lay comatose and terminally ill, apparently unable to face life without her. Howard overcame the limitations of his puerile material by the force and fury of his writing, and by his imagination, which was powerful beyond his hero Conan's wildest dreams of power. In his best work, Howard's writing seems so highly charged with energy that it nearly gives off sparks. Stories such as The People of the Black Circle glow with the fierce and eldritch light of his frenzied intensity. At his best, Howard was the Thomas Wolfe of fantasy, and most of his Conan tales seem to almost fall over themselves in their need to get out. Yet his other work was either unremarkable or just abysmal. The word will hurt and anger his legion of fans, but I don't believe any other word fits. Robert Bloch, one of Howard's contemporaries, suggested in his first letter to Weird Tales that even Conan wasn't that much shakes. Bloch's idea was that Conan should be banished to the outer darkness, where he could use his sword to cut out paper dolls. Needless to say, the suggestion did not go over well with the marching hordes of Conan fans. They probably would have lynched poor Bob Bloch on the spot, had they caught up with him back there in Milwaukee. Even below the sword and sorcery stories are the superheroes, who populate the comic magazines of the only two remaining giants in the field. Although giants is almost too strong a word, according to a survey published in a 1978 issue of Warren's Creepy Magazine, comic readership has gone into what may be an irrecoverable skid. These characters, traditionally called long underwear heroes by the bullpen artists who draw them, are invincible. Blood never flows from their magical bodies. They are somehow able to bring such colorful villains as Lex Luthor and the Sandman to justice without ever having to remove their masks and testify against them in open court. They are sometimes down, but never out. One reason for the success of Marvel's Spider-Man when he burst on the comics scene in the early 60s may have been his vulnerability. He was, and is, an engaging exception to the standard comic book formula. There is something winning in his vulnerability as Peter Parker and in his frequent klutziness as Spider-Man. After being bitten by that radioactive spider, Peter originally felt no holy desire to fight crime. He decided instead to make a bundle in showbiz. Before long, however, he discovers a truth which is bitter to him and amusing to the reader. No matter how great you looked on The Sullivan Show, Marine Midland Bank still won't cash a check made out to the Amazing Spider-Man. Such touches of realism, laced with rue, can be traced to Stan Lee, Spider-Man's creator and the man probably most responsible for keeping the comic book from going the way of the pulps and the dime novels in the 60s and 70s. At the other end of the spectrum are the characters of fantasy who are either powerless and discover power within themselves, as Thomas Covenant discovers it in Stephen Donaldson's remarkable Thomas Covenant, The Unbeliever trilogy, or as Frodo discovers it in Tolkien's epic tale of the Rings, or characters who lose power and then find it again, as Scott Carey does in The Shrinking Man. Horror fiction, as we've said before, is one small circular area in the larger circle of fantasy. And what is fantasy fiction but tales of magic? And what are tales of magic but stories of power? One word nearly defines the other. Power is magic, power is potency. The opposite of potency is impotence, and impotence is the loss of the magic. There is no impotence in the stories of the sword and sorcery genre, nor in those stories of Batman and Superman and Captain Marvel, which we read as children and then, hopefully, gave up as we moved on to more challenging literature and wider views of what the life experience really is. The great theme of fantasy fiction is not holding the magic and wielding it, If so, Sauron, not Frodo, would have been the hero of Tolkien's Rings cycle. It is, or so it seems to me, finding the magic and discovering how it works. In getting back to the Matheson novel, shrinking itself is an oddly arresting concept, isn't it? Tons of symbolism come immediately to mind, most of it revolving around the potency-impotency thing, sexual and otherwise. In Matheson's book, shrinking is most important because Scott Carey begins by perceiving size as power, size as potency, size as magic. When he begins to shrink, he begins to lose all three, or so he believes, until his perceptions change. His reaction to his loss of power, potency, and magic is most commonly a blind, bellowing rage.
"What do you think I'm going to do?" he burst out. "Go on letting them play with me? Oh, you haven't been there. You haven't seen. They're like kids with a new toy. A shrinking man. God almighty, a shrinking man. It makes their damn eyes light up."
Like Thomas Covenant's constant cries of, "By hell," in the Donaldson trilogy, Scott's rage does not hide his impotency, but highlights it. And it is Scott's fury which in a large part makes him such an interesting, believable character. He is not Conan or Superman. Scott bleeds plenty before escaping his cellar prison, and as we watch him go ever more frantically about the task of trying to escape, we suspect at times that he is more than half mad. Or Doc Savage. Scott doesn't always know what to do. He fumbles the ball frequently, and when he does, he goes on to do what most of us would probably do under the circumstances. He has the adult equivalent of a tantrum. In fact, if we regard Scott's shrinking as a symbol for any incurable disease, and the progress of any incurable disease entails a kind of power loss which is analogous to shrinking, we see a pattern which psychologists would outline pretty much as Matheson wrote it, only the outline came years later. Scott follows this course from disbelief to rage to depression to final acceptance almost exactly. As with cancer patients, the final trick seems to be to accept the inevitable, perhaps to find fresh lines of power leading back into the magic. In Scott's case, in the case of many terminal patients, the final outward sign of this is an admission of the inevitable, followed by a kind of euphoria. We can understand Matheson's decision to use flashbacks in order to get to the good stuff early on, but one wonders what might have happened if he had given us the story in a straight line. We see Scott's loss of power in several widely spaced episodes. He is chased by teenagers at one point. They think, and why not, that he is just a little kid. And at another, he hitches a ride with a man who turns out to be a homosexual. He begins to feel an increasing disrespect from his daughter, Beth, partly because of the might makes right idea that works unobtrusively but powerfully in even the most enlightened parent-child relationships. Or we could say, might makes power, or might makes magic. But perhaps mostly because his steady shrinking causes Beth to have to constantly restructure her feelings about her father, who ends up living in a dollhouse before his fall into the cellar. We can even blackly visualize Beth, who doesn't really understand what's happening, inviting her friends in on a rainy day to play with her daddy. But Scott's most painful problems are with Lou, his wife. They are both personal and sexual. And I think that most men, even today, tend to identify the magic most strongly with sexual potency. A woman may not want to, but she can. A man may want to, and find he cannot. Bad news. And when Scott is 4 feet 1 inch tall, he comes home from the medical center, where he's been undergoing tests, and walks straight into a situation where the loss of sexual magic becomes painfully evident.
Louise looked up, smiling.
"You look so nice and clean," she said.
It was not the words or the look on her face, but suddenly he was terribly conscious of his size. Lips twitching into the semblance of a smile, he walked over to the couch and sat down beside her, instantly sorry that he had. She sniffed.
You smell nice," she said.
"You look nice," he said.
"Beautiful."
"Beautiful," she scoffed.
"Not me."
He leaned over abruptly and kissed her warm throat. She raised her left hand and stroked his cheek slowly.
"So nice and smooth," she murmured.
He swallowed. Was she actually talking to him as if he were a boy? And a few minutes later, he let breath trickle slowly from his nostrils.
"I guess it would be rather grotesque anyway. It'd be like..."
"Honey, please."
She wouldn't let him finish.
"You're making it worse than it is."
"Look at me," he said. "How much worse can it get?"
Later on, in another flashback, we see Scott as a voyeur, spying on the babysitter Louise has hired to care for Beth. In a series of comic, horrible scenes, Scott turns the pimply, overweight babysitter into a kind of masturbatory dream goddess. In his doubling back to powerless early adolescence, Matheson is able to show us just how much of the sexual magic Scott has lost. But at a carnival some weeks later, Scott is a foot and a half tall at this point. He meets Clarice, a sideshow midget. And in his encounter with Clarice, we have our clearest indication of Matheson's belief that the lost magic can be found again, that the magic exists on many levels and thus becomes the unifying force that makes macrocosm and microcosm one and the same. When he first meets Clarice, Scott is a bit taller than she, and in her trailer he finds a world which is once more in perspective. It is an environment where he can reassert his own power. Breath stopped. It was his world, his very own world. Chairs and a couch he could sit on without being engulfed, tables he could stand beside and reach across instead of walk under, lamps he could switch on and off, not stand futilely beneath as if they were trees. And, almost needless to relate, he also rediscovers the sexual magic with Clarice in an episode which is both pathetic and touching. We understand he will lose this magic as well, sinking away from Clarice's level until she is also a giant to him. And while these episodes are somewhat softened by the flashback form, the point is nevertheless made. What can be found once can be found again. And the incident of Clarice most clearly justifies the novel's odd but strangely powerful ending. He thought, if nature existed on endless levels, so also might intelligence. Scott Carey ran into his new world, searching. Not, we devoutly hope, to be eaten by the first garden slug or amoeba to cross his path. In the movie version, which Matheson also wrote, Scott's final line is a triumphant, "I still exist," accompanied by shots of nebulae and exploding galaxies. I asked him if this had religious connotations, or perhaps reflected an early interest in life after death, a subject which has become more and more important in Matheson's later work, see Hell House and What Dreams May Come. Matheson comments, "Scott Carey's I Still Exist, I think, only implied a continuum between macroscopic and microscopic, not between life and life after death. Interestingly, I was on the verge of doing a rewrite of The Fantastic Voyage, which Columbia is supposed to be making. I couldn't get involved in it because it was so technical, and I would rather be involved with character now. But it was like a small continuation of the end of The Shrinking Man into the microscopic world with Rod and Gun." Overall, we can say that The Shrinking Man is a classic survival story. There is really only one character, and the questions here are elemental. Food, shelter, survival, destruction of the nemesis. The Dionysian force in Scott's mostly Apollonian cellar world. It is by no means a tremendously sexy book, but sex is at least dealt with on a level more thoughtful than the Shel Scott wham-bam-thank-you-ma'am level that was a common one for paperback originals in the 50s. Matheson was an important figure in pioneering the right of science fiction and fantasy writers to deal with sexual problems in a realistic and sensitive way. Others involved in the same struggle, and it was a struggle, would have included Philip Jose Farmer, Harlan Ellison, and, perhaps most importantly of all, Theodore Sturgeon. It is hard to believe now what a furor was caused by the concluding pages of Sturgeon's Some of Your Blood, when it is revealed exactly how the vampire has been obtaining his supply.
"The moon is full,"
he writes both wistfully and chillingly to his girlfriend in the book's final paragraph,
"and I wish I had some of your blood."
But the furor happened. We may wish that Matheson had dealt with the sexual angle a little less solemnly, but in light of the times, I think we can applaud the fact that he dealt with the sexual angle at all. And as a fable of losing power and finding it, The Shrinking Man ranks as one of the finest fantasies of the period we've been discussing, and I don't want to leave you with the impression that I'm only talking here about sexual power and sexual potency. There are tiresome critics, the half-baked Freudians mostly, who want to relate all of fantasy and horror fiction back to sex. One explanation for the conclusion of The Shrinking Man, which I heard at a party in the fall of 1978, I'll not mention the name of the woman whose theory this was, but if you read science fiction, you'd know the name, maybe bears repeating since we're on this. In symbolic terms, this woman said, spiders represent the vagina. Scott finally kills his nemesis, the Black Widow, the most vaginal of all spiders, by impaling it on a pin. The phallic symbol. Get it? Get it? Thus, this critic went on, after failing at sex with his wife, succeeding at first with the carnival midget, Clarice, and then losing her, Scott symbolically kills his own sex drive by impaling the spider. This is his last sexual act before escaping the cellar and achieving a wider freedom. All of this was well-meaning bullshit, but bullshit is still bullshit, and will never be mistaken for McDonald's secret sauce. I bring it up only to point out that it is the sort of bullshit that a lot of fantasy and horror writers have had to labor under. Most of it spread by people who believe either secretly or openly that the horror writer must be suffering from madness to a greater or a lesser degree. The further view of such folks is that the writer's books are Rorschach inkblots that will eventually reveal the author's anal, oral, or genital fixation. In writing about the largely scoffing reaction that Leslie Fiedler's Love and Death in the American Novel received when it was published in 1960, Wilfred Sheed adds, "Freudian interpretations are always greeted by guffaws." Not much bad news at that, when you remember that even the most staid novelists are regarded as a bit peculiar by their neighbors. But the horror novelist is always going to have to face what I think of as the couch questions, I guess. And most of us are perfectly normal. Freudian hugger-mugger set aside, The Shrinking Man can be seen as just a pretty good story which happens to deal with the interior politics of power, or if you like, and I do, the interior politics of magic. And Scott's killing of the spider is meant to show us that the magic is not dependent on size, but upon mind and heart. If it stands considerably taller than other books in the genre, small pun much intended, and far above other books where tiny people battle beetles and praying mantises and such, Lindsay Gutteridge's Cold War in a Country Garden comes to mind, it is because Matheson couches his story in such intimate and riveting terms, and because he is ultimately so persuasive. This examination of lives in microcosm continues to hold a fascination for writers and readers. Early this year, Macmillan published Small World by Tabitha King, a malign comedy of manners revolving around a fabulously expensive presidential dollhouse, a nymphomaniacal presidential daughter, and an overweight mad scientist who is as pitiable as he is frightening. Published in 1981, it lies outside the temporal borders of this book, which is probably just as well. The lady is my wife, and my view would be prejudiced. So I'll only add that my prejudiced view is that Small World is a wonderful addition to this HO scale subgenre. 8. It wouldn't be right to wind up even so brief a discussion of the modern horror novel as this one without mentioning two young British writers, Ramsay Campbell and James Herbert. They are a part of a whole new generation of British fantasy writers who seem to be revitalizing the genre by cross-fertilization, much as British poets helped to revitalize American poetry during the early 60s. Besides Campbell and Herbert, the two who are perhaps best known over here, there is Robert Aickman, who could hardly be called a young Turk, but since such books as Cold Hand and Mine have brought him to a wider American audience, it seems fair enough to classify him as part of the British New Wave. Nick Sharman, Thomas Tessier, an American living in London, who has recently published a novel called The Night Walker, perhaps the finest werewolf novel of the last 20 years, and a score of others. As Paul Theroux, another expatriate American living in London, has pointed out, there is something uniquely British about the tale of horror, perhaps particularly those which deal with the archetype of the ghost. Theroux, who has written his own low-key horror tale, The Black House, favors the mannered but grisly tales of M.R. James, and they do seem to summarize everything that is best in the classic British horror story. Ramsay Campbell and James Herbert are both modernists, and while this family is really too small to avoid a certain resemblance, even in cousins twice removed, it seems to me that both of these men, who are worlds apart in terms of style, point of view, and method of attack, are doing things that are exciting and worthy of mention. Campbell, a Liverpudlian, "You talk just like one of the Beatles," a woman marvels to a writer from Liverpool in Campbell's new novel, The Parasite, writes a cool, almost icy prose line, and his perspective on his native Liverpool is always a trifle offbeat, a trifle unsettling. In a Campbell novel or story, one seems to view the world through the thin and shifting perceptual haze of an LSD trip that is just ending, or just beginning. The polish of his writing and his mannered turns of phrase and image make him seem something like the genre's Joyce Carol Oates. And like Oates, he is prolific, turning out good short stories, novels, and essays at an amazing clip. And there is also something Oatesian in the way his characters view the world, as when one is journeying on mild LSD, there is something chilly and faintly schizophrenic in the way his characters see things, and in the things they see. These are the perceptions of Rose, as she shops in a Liverpool department store in The Parasite. A group of toddlers watched her pass, their eyes painted into their sockets. On the ground floor, red and pink and yellow hands on stalks reached for her from the glove counter. Blind mauve faces craned on necks as long as arms, wigs roosted on their heads. The bald man was still staring at her. His head, which looked perched on top of a bookcase, shone like plastic beneath the fluorescent lights. His eyes were bright, flat, expressionless as glass. She thought of a display head stripped of its wig. When a fat pink tongue squeezed out between his lips, it was as if a plastic head had come to life.
"Good stuff, but strange. So uniquely Campbell that it might as well be trademarked. Good horror novels are not a dime a dozen by no means, but there never seems to be any serious shortage of good ones either. And by that I mean that you seem to be able to count on a really good novel of horror and or the supernatural, or at least a really interesting one, every year or so. And much the same could be said for the horror films. A vintage year may produce as many as 3 amid the paperback original dreck about hateful paranormal children and presidential candidates from hell, and the too large collection of hardcover boners, such as the recent Virgin by James Peterson. But maybe paradoxically, maybe not, good horror writers are quite rare, and Campbell is better than just good. That's one reason fans of the genre will greet The Parasite with such pleasure and relief. It is even better than his first novel, of which I want to treat briefly here. Campbell has been turning out his own patented brand of short horror tale for some years now. Like Bradbury and Robert Bloch, Arkham House published Ramsay Campbell's first book, The Inhabitant of the Lake, which was a Lovecraft clone. Several collections of his stories are available, the best of them probably being The Height of the Scream. A story you will not find in that book, unfortunately, is The Companion, in which a lonely man who tours fun fairs on his holidays encounters a horror beyond my ability to describe while riding a ghost train into its tunnel. The Companion may be the best horror tale to be written in English in the last 30 years. It is surely one of half a dozen or so which will still be in print and commonly read 100 years from now. Campbell is literate in a field which has attracted too many comic book intellects, cool in a field where too many writers, myself included, tend toward panting melodrama, fluid in a field where many of the best practitioners often fall prey to cant and stupid rules of fantasy composition.
but not all good short story writers in this field are able to make the jump to the novel. Poe tried with the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym and made a conditional success of the job. Lovecraft failed ambitiously twice, with The Strange Case of Charles Dexter Ward and the rather more interesting At the Mountains of Madness, whose plot is remarkably Pym-like. Campbell made the jump almost effortlessly, with a novel as good as its title was off-putting, The Doll Who Ate His Mother. The book was published with absolutely no fanfare in 1977 in hardcover, and then with an even greater lack of fanfare a year later in paperback. One of those cases that make a writer wonder if publishers don't practice their own sort of voodoo, singling certain books out to be ritually slaughtered in the marketplace. Well, never mind that. Concerning the jump from the short story to the novel, writing the latter is much like long-distance running, and you can almost feel some would-be novelists getting tired. You sense they're starting to breathe a trifle hard by page 100, to puff and blow by page 200, and to finally limp over the finish line with little to recommend them beyond the bare fact that they have finished. But Campbell runs well. He is personally an amusing, even a jolly man. At the 1979 World Fantasy Convention, he presented Stephen R. Donaldson with the British Fantasy Award, a modernistic little statuette, for his Thomas Covenant trilogy. Campbell, in that marvelously broad and calm Liverpool accent, referred to it as the skeletal dildo. The audience broke up, and someone at my table marveled, "He sounds just like one of the Beatles." As with Robert Bloch, the last thing you would suspect is that he is a writer of horror fiction, particularly of the grim brand he turns out. Of The Doll Who Ate His Mother, he has this to say, some of it bearing directly on the difference in the amount of endurance needed to do a novel. What I wanted to do with the doll was to invent a new monster, if that is possible, but perhaps the big thing was to actually write the novel, since previously I'd been doing short stories. In 1961 or 62, I made notes for a story about a black magician who was going to take revenge on his town or village for some real or imagined wrong it had done him. He was going to do this by using voodoo dolls to deform the babies. You'd have the standard pulp magazine scene of the white-faced doctor coming out of the delivery room saying, "My God, it's not human!" And the twist was going to be that after all these deformed infants had died, the black magician would use the voodoo dolls to bring them back to life. An amazingly tasteless idea. At about the same time, the thalidomide tragedy occurred, making the story idea a little too topically tasteless for me, and I dropped it. It resurfaced, I suppose, in The Doll Who Ate His Mother, which eats its way out of its mother's womb. How does writing novels differ from writing short stories? I think a novel gathers its own impetus. I have to creep up on it unawares, thinking to myself, maybe I'll start it next week, maybe I'll start it next month. Then one day I sat down, began to write, and looked up at noon, thinking, "My God, I've started a novel. I don't believe it." Kirby McCauley said, when I asked him how long the novel should be, that 70,000 words or so would be about right. And I took him almost literally. When I got up around the 63,000-word mark, I thought, only 7,000 words left. Time to wrap this up. That's why many of the later chapters seem terse. Campbell's novel begins with Claire Frayne's brother Rob losing an arm and his life in a Liverpool car accident. The arm, torn off in the accident, is important because somebody makes off with it and eats it. This muncher of arms, we are led to suppose, is a shadowy young man named Chris Kelly. Claire, who embodies many of the ideas already labeled as New American Gothic, sure, Campbell is British, but many of his influences, both literary and cinematic, are American, meets a crime reporter named Edmund Hall, who believes that the man who caused Rob Frayne's death was the grown-up version of a boy he knew in school, a boy fascinated with death and cannibalism. In dealing with archetypes, I've not suggested that we deal out a tarot card for the ghoul, one of the more grisly creatures in monsterdom, believing that the eating of dead flesh and the drinking of blood are really parts of the same archetype. Stories of ghouls and cannibalism venture into genuine taboo territory, I think. Witness the strong public reactions to George Romero's Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. Something rather more important than a harmless roller coaster ride is going on here, I think. Here's a chance to really grab people by the gag reflex and throttle them. I wrote a story 4 years ago called Survivor Type, which I still have not been able to sell.
Gee,
and people told me that when I got successful, I'd be able to sell my laundry list if I wanted to. It deals with a surgeon who is washed up on an uninhabited island, little more than a scratch of coral above the surface of the Pacific, and eats himself a piece at a time to stay alive. I did everything according to Hoyle, he writes in his diary after amputating his foot. I washed it before I ate it. Not even the men's magazines would consider that one, and it sits in my file cabinet to this day, waiting for a good home. It will probably never find one, though. Is there really such a thing as a new monster? In light of the genre's strictness, I think not, and Campbell must be content instead with a fresh perspective. No mean feat in itself. In Chris Kelly, I believe the face we see is that of our old friend the vampire. As we see it in a movie which resembles Campbell's novel by turns, the brilliant Canadian director David Cronenberg's They Came From Within. Claire, Edmund Hall, and George Pugh, a cinema owner whose elderly mother has also been victimized by Kelly, join together in a strange and reluctant three-way partnership to track this supernatural cannibal down. Here again we feel echoes of the classic tale of the vampire, Stoker's Dracula. And perhaps we never feel the changes of the nearly 80 years which lie between the two books so strongly as we do in the contrast between the group of six which forms to track down Count Dracula and the group of three which forms to track down Chris Kelly. There is no sense of self-righteousness in Claire, Edmund, and George. They are truly little people, afraid, confused, often depressed. They turn inward to themselves rather than outward toward each other. And while we sense their fright very strongly, there is no feeling about the book that Claire, Edmund, and George must prevail because their cause is just. They somehow symbolize the glum and rather drab place England has become in the second half of the 20th century, and we feel that if some or all of them do muddle through, it will be due more to impersonal luck than to any action of their own. And the three of them do track Kelly down, after a fashion. The climax of the hunt takes place in the rotting cellar of a slum building marked for demolition, and here Campbell has created one of the dreamiest and most effective sequences in all of modern horror fiction. In its surreal and nightmarish evocation of ancient evil, in the glimpses it gives us of absolute power, it is finally a voice from the latter part of the 20th century which speaks powerfully in the language which Lovecraft can be said to have invented. Here is nothing so pallid or so imitative as a Lovecraft pastiche, but a viable, believable version of those Lovecraftian elder gods that so haunted Dunwich, Arkham, Providence, Central Falls, and the pages of Weird Tales magazine. Campbell is good, if rather unsympathetic, with character. His lack of emotion has the effect of chilling his prose even further, and some readers will be put off by the tone of this novel. They may feel that Campbell has not so much written a novel as grown one in a petri dish. Claire Frayne, with her stumpy legs and her dreams of grace, Edmund, with his baleful thoughts of glory yet to come, and best of all, because here Campbell does seem to kindle real feelings of emotion and kindliness, George Pugh, holding on to the last of his cinemas, and scolding two teenage girls who walk out before the playing of the national anthem is finished. But perhaps the central character here is Liverpool itself, with its orange sodium lights, its slums and docks, its cinemas converted into half a mile of furniture. Campbell's short stories live and breathe Liverpool in what seems to be equal amounts of attraction and repulsion, and that sense of place is one of the most remarkable things about The Doll as well. This locale is as richly textured as Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles of the 40s and 50s, or Larry McMurtry's Houston of the 60s. Children were playing ball against the church, Campbell writes. Christ held up his arms for a catch. It is a small line, understated and almost thrown away, like all those creepy reaching gloves in The Parasite, But this sort of thing is cumulative, and at least suggests Campbell's commitment to the idea that horror exists in point of view as well as in incident. The doll who ate his mother is not the greatest of the novels discussed here. I suppose that would have to be either The Haunting of Hill House or Straub's Ghost Story, and it is not as good as Campbell's The Parasite. But it is remarkably good. Campbell keeps a tight rein on his potentially tabloid-style material, even playing off it occasionally. A dull and almost viciously insensitive teacher sits in the faculty room of his school, reading a paper with a headline which blares, "He cut up young virgins and laughed." The story's blackly hilarious subhead informs us that his potency came from not having orgasms. He carries us inexorably past levels of abnormal psychology into something that is much, much worse. Campbell is extremely conscious of his literary roots. He mentions Lovecraft, adding, of course, almost unconsciously, Robert Bloch. He compares the doll's climax in The Abandoned Cellar to the climax of Psycho, where Lila Crane must face Norman Bates' mother in a similar basement, and Fritz Lieber's stories of urban horror, such as Smoke Ghost, and more notably, Lieber's eerie novel of San Francisco, Our Lady of Darkness, winner of the Best Novel Award at the 1978 World Fantasy Convention. In Our Lady of Darkness, Lieber adopts as his thesis the idea that when a city becomes complex enough, it may take on a tenebrous life of its own, quite apart from the lives of the people who live and work there, an evil sentience linked, in some unstated way, to the elder ones of Lovecraft, and, more importantly, in terms of the Lieber novel, Clark Ashton Smith. Amusingly, one of the characters in Our Lady of Darkness suggests that San Francisco did not become truly sentient until the Transamerica Pyramid was finished and occupied. While Campbell's Liverpool does not have this kind of conscious evil life, the picture he draws of it gives the reader the feeling that he is observing a slumbering, semi-sentient monster that might awake at any moment. His debt to Lieber seems clearer here than that to Lovecraft, in fact. Either way, Ramsey Campbell has succeeded in forging something uniquely his own in The Doll Who Ate His Mother. James Herbert, on the other hand, comes from an older tradition, the same sort of pulp horror fiction that we associate with writers such as Robert E. Howard, Seabury Quinn, the early Sturgeon, the early Henry Kuttner, and on the English side of the Atlantic, Guy Ann Smith. Smith, the author of paperback originals Beyond Counting, has written a novel whose title is my nominee for the all-time pulp horror classic, The Sucking Pit. This sounds as if I were getting ready to knock Herbert, but this isn't the case. It's true that he is held in remarkably low esteem by writers in the genre of both sides of the Atlantic. When I've mentioned his name in the past, noses have automatically wrinkled. It's a little like ringing a bell in order to watch conditioned dogs salivate. But when you inquire more closely, you find that remarkably few people in the field have actually read Herbert. And the fact is that James Herbert is probably the best writer of pulp horror to come along since the death of Robert E. Howard. And I believe that Conan's creator would have responded to Herbert's work with immediate enthusiasm. Although the two men were opposite in many ways, Howard was big and broad-shouldered. The face in those pictures which remain to us is expressionless, with, we might think, undertones of either shyness or suspicion. James Herbert is of medium height, slim, quick to smile or frown, open and frank. Of course, the biggest difference may be that Howard is dead, and Herbert ain't. Ha ha! Howard's best work, his stories of Conan the Barbarian, are in the mythic country of Sumeria, far in a similarly mythic past, inhabited by monsters and beautiful sexy maidens in need of rescue. And Conan will be happy to effect said rescue, if the price is right. Herbert's work is set firmly in England's present, most commonly against the backdrop of London or the southern counties which surround it. Howard was brought up in rural circumstances. He lived and died in a small sagebrush town called Cross Plains, Texas. Herbert was born in London's East End, the son of street traders, and his work reflects a checkered career as a rock and roll singer, artist, and ad executive. It is in the elusive matter of style, a confusing word that may be most accurately defined as plan or method of attack, that Herbert strongly recalls the Howard that was. In his novels of horror, The Rats, The Fog, The Survivor, The Spear, The Lair, and The Dark, Herbert does not just write. As Robert E. Howard did, he puts on his combat boots and goes out to assault the reader with horror. Let me also take a moment to point out one similarity that James Herbert and Ramsey Campbell do share, simply by virtue of their Englishness. They both write that clear, lucid, grammatical prose that only those educated in England seem able to produce. You'd think that the ability to write lucid prose would be the bottom line for any publishing novelist, but it is not so. If you don't believe me, go check out the paperback originals rack at your local bookstore. I promise you such a carnival of dangling participles, misplaced modifiers, and even lack of agreement between subject and verb that your hair may turn white. You would expect that proofreaders and copy editors would pick this sort of stuff up, even if the writers of such embarrassing English do not, but many of them seem as illiterate as the writers they are trying to bail out. Worse than the mechanical errors, many writers of fiction seem totally unable to explain simple operations or actions clearly enough for the reader to be able to see them in his or her mind's eye. Some of this is a failure on the writer's part to visualize well and completely. His or her own mind's eye seems bleared half-shut. More of it is a simple failure of that most basic writer's tool, the working vocabulary. If you're writing a haunted house story and you don't know the difference between a gable and a gambrel, a cupola and a turret, paneling and wainscoting, you, sir or madam, are in trouble. Now don't get me wrong here. I thought Edwin Newman's book on the degeneration of the English language was moderately entertaining, but also often tiresome and amazingly prissy. The book of a man who would like to put language inside a hermetically sealed bell jar, like a carefully groomed corpse inside a glass coffin, instead of sending it out into the streets to jive with the people. But language has its own point and reason for being. Parapsychologists may argue over extrasensory perception. Psychologists and neurologists may claim there is no such thing. But those who love books and love the language know that the printed word really is a kind of telepathy. In most cases, the writer does her or his work silently, couching thoughts in symbols composed of letters, in groups, set off one from the next by white space. And in most cases, the reader does her or his work silently, reading the symbols and reintegrating them as thoughts and images. Louis Zukofsky, the poet, A, among other books, claimed that even the look of words on the page, the indents, the punctuation, the place on the line where the paragraph ends, has its own story to tell. Prose, Zukofsky said, is poetry. It's probably true that the writer's thoughts and the reader's thoughts never tally exactly, that the image the writer sees and the image the reader sees are never 100% the same. We are, after all, not angels, but we're made a little less than the angels, and our language is maddeningly hobbled, a fact to which any poet or novelist will attest. There is no creative writer, I think, who has not suffered that frustrating crash off the walls which stand at the limits of language, who has not cursed the word that just doesn't exist. Emotions such as grief and romantic love are particularly hard to deal with, but even such a simple operation as starting up a car with a manual transmission and driving it to the end of the block can present nearly insurmountable problems if you try to write the process down instead of simply doing it. And if you don't believe this is so, write down such instructions and try them on a non-driving friend. But check your auto insurance policy first. Different languages seem particularly suited to different purposes. The French may have gotten a reputation for being great lovers because the French language seems particularly well suited to the expression of emotion. There is no nicer way to say it than je t'aime, and no better language in which to sound really jacked off at someone. German is the language of explanation and clarification, but it is a cold language for all that. The sound of many people speaking German is the sound of large machines running in a factory. English serves very well to express thought, and moderately well to express image, but there is nothing inherently lovely about it. Although, as someone has pointed out, it has its queerly perverse moments. Think of the lovely and euphonious sound of the words, proctological examination. It has always seemed to me ill-suited to the expression of feeling, though. Neither, why don't we go to bed together, or the cheerful but undeniably crude, baby, let's fuck, can touch, voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir? But we must do the best we can with what we have. And, as readers of Shakespeare and Faulkner will attest, the best we can do is often remarkably good. American writers are more apt to mangle the language than our British cousins, although I'd argue with anyone that English English is much more bloodless than American English. Many British writers have the unhappy habit of droning in perfectly grammatical English. But a drone is still a drone for all that and all that. Often because they were subjected to poor or erratic teaching methods as children. But the best American work is striking in a way that British prose and poetry rarely is anymore. See, for instance, such disparate writers as James Dickey, Harry Cruse, Joan Didion, Ross MacDonald, John Irving. Both Campbell and Herbert write that unmistakable, impeccable English line, "Their stories go out into the world with their pants buttoned, their zippers zipped, and their braces in their places." But to what a different ultimate effect! James Herbert comes at us with both hands, not willing to simply engage our attention. He seizes us by the lapels and begins to scream in our faces. It is not a tremendously artistic method of attack, and no one is ever going to compare him to Doris Lessing or V.S. Naipaul. But it works. The Fog, no relation to the film of the same name by John Carpenter, is a multiple viewpoint story about what happens when an underground explosion breaches a steel canister that has been buried by the British Ministry of Defense. The canister contains a living organism called a mycoplasma, an ominous protoplasm that may remind readers of an obscure Japanese horror film from the 50s titled The H-Man, which resembles a smoggy yellow-green mist. Like rabies, it attacks the brains of the humans and animals it envelops, turning them into raving maniacs. Some of the incidents involving animals are particularly grisly. A farmer is trampled to death by his own cows in a foggy pasture, and a drunken shopkeeper, who seems to loathe everything but his racing pigeons, and one battered old campaigner in particular, a pigeon named Claude, has his eyes picked out by his birds, who have flown back to their London coop through the fog. The shopkeeper, clutching the remains of his face, staggers off the rooftop, where the birds are quartered, and falls to his death. Herbert rarely finesses and never pulls back from the crunch. Instead, he seems to race eagerly, zestfully, toward each new horror. In one scene, a crazed bus driver castrates the teacher who has been his nemesis with a pair of garden shears. In another, an elderly poacher who has been previously caught and thrashed by the local large landowner suffers the effects of the fog, goes after the landowner, and nails him to his own dining room table before finishing him off with an axe. A snotty bank manager is locked in his own vault. A gym teacher is beaten to death by his phys ed students. And in the book's most effective scene, almost 150,000 residents and holidaymakers at Bournemouth walk into the ocean in a massive, lemming-like group suicide. The Fog was published in 1975, 3 years before the gruesome events at Jonestown, Guyana, and in many of the book's episodes, particularly in the Bournemouth episode, Herbert seems to have forecast it. We see the event through the eyes of a young woman named Mavis Evers. Her lesbian lover has just left her, having discovered the joys of going hetero. And Mavis has gone to Bournemouth to commit suicide. A little irony worthy of EC Comics at their best. She wades breast-deep into the water, becomes frightened, and decides she will try living a little longer. The undertow nearly gets her, but following a short, tense struggle, she is able to get to shallow water again. Turning to face the shore, Mavis is greeted by this nightmare. There were hundreds, could it be thousands, of people climbing down the steps to the beach,
and walking toward her, toward the sea. Was she dreaming? The people of the town were marching in a solid wall out to the sea, making no sound, staring toward the horizon as though something was beckoning to them. Their faces were white, trance-like, barely human. And there were children among them. Some walked along on their own, seeming to belong to no one. Those that couldn't walk were being carried. Most of the people were in their nightclothes. Some were naked, having risen from their beds as though answering a call that Mavis neither heard nor saw. This was written before the Jonestown tragedy, remember? In the aftermath of that, I recall one commentator intoning with dark and solemn sonorousness, "It was an event that not even the most darkly fertile imagination could have envisioned." I flashed on the Bournemouth scene from the fog and thought, "You're wrong. James Herbert envisioned it." Still they came on, oblivious to her cries, unseeing. She realized her danger and ran toward them in a vain attempt to break through, but they forced her back, heedless of her pleas as she strained against them. She managed to push a short path through them, but the great numbers before her were unconquerable, pushing her back, back into the waiting sea. Well, as you probably guessed, poor old Mavis gets her suicide whether she wants it or not. And in point of fact, it is explicit scenes of horror and violence like the one just described which have made Herbert the focus of a great deal of criticism in his native England. He told me that he finally got sick enough of the "do you write violence for the sake of violence" question to finally blow up at a reporter. "That's right," he said. "I write violence for the sake of violence, just as Harold Robbins writes sex for the sake of sex, and Robert Heinlein writes science fiction for the sake of science fiction, and Margaret Drabble writes literature for the sake of literature. Except no one ever asks them, do they?" As to how Herbert came to write The Fog, he replies, "It's about impossible to remember where any idea comes from. I mean, a single idea may come from many sources, but as clearly as I can recall, the kernel came during a business meeting. I was with an advertising firm then, and sitting in the office of my creative director, who was a rather dull man. And all of a sudden it occurred to me, what would happen if this man just turned, walked to the window, opened it, and stepped out?" Herbert turned the idea over in his mind for some time and finally sat down to do the novel, spending about 8 months' worth of weekends and late nights getting it together. "The thing I like best about it," he says, "is that it had no limits of structure or place. It could simply go on and on until the thing resolved itself. I liked working with my main characters, but I also liked the vignettes, because when I got tired of what my heroes were up to, I could go off on just about any tangent I liked. My feeling throughout the writing was, I'm just going to enjoy myself. I'm going to try to go over the top, to see how much I can get away with." In its construction, The Fog shows the effect of those apocalyptic big bug movies of the late 50s and early 60s. All the ingredients are there. We have a mad scientist who was screwing around with something he didn't understand and was killed by the mycoplasma he invented. The military testing secret weapons and unleashing the horror. The young scientist hero, John Holman, who we first meet bravely rescuing a little girl from the fissure that has unleashed the fog on an unsuspecting world. The beautiful girlfriend, Casey. The obligatory gathering of scientists who natter about the F-100 method of fog dispersion, and lament the fact that carbon dioxide can't be used to disperse the fog, because the organism thrives on it, and who inform us that the fog is really a pleuropneumonia-like organism. We will recognize these obligatory trappings of science fiction from such movies as Tarantula, The Deadly Mantis, Them, and a dozen others. Yet we will also recognize that trappings are all they are. And the heart of Herbert's novel lies not in the fog's origin or composition, but in its decidedly Dionysian effects. Murder, suicide, sexual aberrations, and all manner of deviant behavior. Holman, the hero, is our representative from a saner Apollonian world. And to do Herbert full justice,
he manages to make Holman a good deal more interesting than the zero heroes played by William Hopper, Craig Stevens, and Peter Graves in various of the Big Bug films. Or consider, if you will, poor old Hugh Marlowe in Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, whose entire set of lines during the last third of the movie seems to consist of, "Keep firing at saucer!" and "Fire at saucer until it crashes!" Nonetheless, our interests in Holman's adventures and whether or not his girlfriend Casey will recover from the effects of her own bout with the fog, and what will be her reaction to the information that she plunged the scissors into her father's stomach while under the influence, seems pallid when compared to our morbid, let's slow down and look at the accident, interest in the old lady who was eaten alive by her pet cats, or the crazed pilot who crashes his loaded jumbo jet into the London skyscraper where his wife's lover works. I suppose that popular fiction divides itself quite naturally into two halves, what we call mainstream fiction and that which I would call pulp fiction. The pulps, including the so-called shutter pulps, of which Weird Tales was the finest exponent, have been long gone from the scene, but they live on in the novel and do a brisk business on paperback racks everywhere. Many of these modern pulps would have been printed as multi-part serials in the pulp magazines that existed roughly from 1910 until about 1950, had they been written during that period. But I wouldn't restrict the label pulp simply to genre works of horror, fantasy, science fiction, detective, and western. Arthur Haley, for instance, seems to me to be writing modern-day pulp. The ingredients are all there, from the inevitable violence to the inevitable maiden in distress. The critics who have regularly toasted Haley over the coals are the same critics who, infuriatingly enough, see the novel as divisible only into two categories, literature, which may either succeed or fail upon its merits, and popular fiction, which always fails, no matter how good it may be. Every now and then a writer such as John D. MacDonald may be elevated in the critical mind from a writer of popular fiction to a writer of literature, at which point his body of work may be safely reevaluated. My own idea is that fiction actually falls into three main categories: literature, mainstream fiction, and pulp fiction, and that to categorize does not end the critic's job, but only gives him or her a place to set his or her feet. To label a novel pulp is not the same as saying it's a bad novel, or will give the reader no pleasure. Of course, we will readily accept that most pulp fiction is indeed bad. There is not a great deal one can say in defense of such brass oldies from the pulp era as William Shelton's Seven Heads of Bushongo, or Satan's Virgin by Ray Cummings. And there's a wonderful story about Earl Stanley Gardner's days in what Frank Gruber used to call the pulp jungle. At that time, the Depression was in full swing and Gardner was writing westerns for a penny a word, selling to such publications as Western Roundup, West Weekly, and Western Tales, whose slogan was, 15 stories, 15 cents. Gardner admitted that he made a habit of stretching the final shootout as far as it would go. Of course, the bad guy finally bit the dust and the good guy strode into the saloon, 44s smoking and spurs jingling, or a cold Sir Sarsaparilla before moving on. But in the meantime, each time Gardner wrote bang, he made another penny. And in those days, two bangs would buy you the daily newspaper. On the other hand, though, Dashiell Hammett published extensively in the pulps, most notably in the highly regarded Black Mask, where contemporaries Raymond Chandler, James M. Cain, and Cornell Woolrich also published. Tennessee Williams's first published work, a vaguely Lovecraftian tale titled The Vengeance of Nitocris, appeared in an early issue of Weird Tales. Bradbury broke in by way of the same market. So did McKinley Cantor, who would go on to write Andersonville. To condemn pulp writing out of hand is like condemning a girl as loose simply because she comes from unpleasant family circumstances. The fact that supposedly reputable critics, both in the genre and outside it, continue to do so make me both sad and angry. James Herbert is not a nascent Tennessee Williams only waiting for the right time to spin a cocoon and emerge as a great figure of modern literature. He is what he is, and that's all that he is, as Popeye would say. My point is simply that what he is good enough. I loved John Jakes's comment on his bicentennial Kent family saga some years back. He said that Gore Vidal was the Rolls-Royce of historical novelists, that he himself was more in the Chevrolet Vega class. What Jakes so modestly left unstated was that both vehicles will get you where you want to go quite adequately. How you feel about style is between you and you. James Herbert is the only writer discussed in these pages who is squarely in the pulp tradition. He specializes in violent death, bloody confrontation, explicit and in some cases kinky sex, strong and virile young heroes possessed of beautiful girlfriends. The problem which needs to be solved is in most cases apparent, and the story's emphasis is put squarely on solving that problem. But Herbert works effectively within his chosen genre. He has consistently refused, from the very first, to be satisfied with characters who are nothing more than cardboard cutouts which he moves around the playing field of his novel. In most cases, we are given motivations we can identify with and believe in, as in the case of poor, suicide-bound Mavis. Mavis reflects with a kind of pitiful, deranged defiance that she wanted them to know she had taken her own life. Her death, unlike her life, had to have some meaning, even if it was only Ronnie who fully understood that reason. This is hardly stunning character insight, but it is fully adequate to Herbert's purposes, and if the ironic outcome is similar to the ironic outcome of the Tales in EC's series of horror comics, we are able to see more and thus believe more, a victory for Herbert which the reader can share. Further, Herbert has continued to improve. The Fog is his second novel. Those that follow show a gratifying development in the writer, culminating perhaps in The Spear, which shows us a writer who has stepped out of the pulp arena altogether and has entered the wider field of the mainstream novel. 9. Which brings us to Harlan Ellison, and all kinds of problems, because here it is impossible to separate the man from the work. I've decided to close this brief review of some of the elements in modern horror fiction by discussing Ellison's work because, although he repudiates the label horror writer, he sums up, for me, the finest elements of the term. Closing with Ellison is perhaps almost mandatory because in his short stories of fantasy and horror, he strikes closest to all those things which horrify and amuse us, sometimes both at the same time, in our present lives. Ellison is haunted by the death of Kitty Genovese, a murder that comes up in his The Whimper of Whipped Dogs and in several of his essays, the mass suicides in Jonestown, and he is convinced that Iran's Ayatollah has created a senile dream of power in which we are now all living, like men and women in a fantasy tale who ultimately come to realize they are living in a psychotic's hallucinations. Most of all, it seems to me that Ellison's work is the proper place to conclude, because he never looks back. He has been the field's point man for 15 years now, and if there is such a thing as a fantasist for the 1980s, always assuming there are a 1980s, then Harlan Ellison is almost surely that writer. He has quite deliberately provoked a storm of controversy over his own work. One writer in the field whom I know considers him to be a modern incarnation of Jonathan Swift, and another regularly refers to him as that no-talent son of a bitch. It is a storm that Ellison lives in quite contentedly. "You're not a writer at all," an interviewer once told me in slightly wounded tones. "You're a goddamn industry. How do you ever expect serious people to take you seriously if you keep turning out a book a year?" Well, in point of fact, I'm not a goddamn industry, unless it's a cottage industry. I work steadily, that's all. Any writer who only produces a book every 7 years is not thinking deep thoughts. Even a long book takes at most 3 years to think and write. No, a writer who only produces one book every 7 years is simply dicking off. But my own fecundity, however fecund that may be, pales before Ellison's, who has written at a ferocious clip. At this point, he has published just over 1,000 short stories. In addition to all the stories published under his own name, Ellison has written as Nalra Nazil, Slay Harson, Landon Ellis, Derry Tiger, Price Curtis, Paul Merchant, Lee Archer, E.K. Jarvis, Ivor Jorgensen, Clyde Mitchell, Ellis Hart, Jay Solo, Jay Charby, Wallace Edmondson, and Cord Wayner Bird. All quoted in the Ellison entry by John Clute and Peter Nichols in The Science Fiction Encyclopedia. To point out the obvious, Nalra Nazil is Harlan Ellison, spelled backwards. Other names Ellison used, E.K. Jarvis, Ivor Jorgensen, and Clyde Mitchell, were so-called house names. In pulp terminology, a house name was the name of a totally fictional writer who was, nevertheless, extremely prolific, mostly because several, sometimes dozens, of writers published works under that name when they had another story in the same magazine. Thus, Ivor Jorgensen wrote Ellison-style fantasy when he was Ellison and sexy pulp-style horror, as in the Jorgensen novel Rest in Agony, when he was someone else, in this case, Paul Fairman. To this should be added that Ellison has since acknowledged all of his pseudonymous work and has published only under his own name since 1965. He has, he says, a lemming-like urge to be up front. The Cord Wayner Bird name is a good example of Ellison's restless wit and his anger at work he feels to be substandard dreck. Since the early 60s, he has done many TV scripts, including produced scripts for Alfred Hitchcock Presents, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., The Young Lawyers, The Outer Limits, and what many fans feel may have been the best Star Trek episode of them all, The City on the Edge of Forever. This may be the longest footnote in history, but I really must pause and tell two more Harlan stories, one apocryphal, the other Harlan's version of the same incident. The apocryphal, which I first heard at a science fiction bookstore, and later at several different fantasy and science fiction conventions, it was told that Paramount Pictures had a pre-production conference of big-name science fiction writers prior to shooting on Star Trek, the movie. The purpose of the conference was to toss around ideas for a mission that would be big enough to fly the starship Enterprise from the cathode tube to the silver screen, and big was the word that the exec in charge of the conference kept emphasizing. One writer suggested that the Enterprise might be sucked into a black hole. The Disney people scoffed that idea up about 3 months later. The Paramount exec didn't think that was big enough. Another suggested that Kirk, Spock, and company might discover a pulsar that was, in fact, a living organism. Still not big enough, the writer was admonished. The writers were again reminded that they should think big. According to the tale, Ellison sat silent, doing a slow burn. Only with Harlan, a slow burn lasts only about 5 seconds. Finally, he spoke up. The Enterprise, he said, goes through an interstellar warp, the great granddaddy of all interstellar warps. It's transported over a google of light years in the space of seconds and comes out at a huge gray wall. The wall marks the edge of the entire universe. Scotty rigs full-charge ion blasters, which breach the wall so they can see what's beyond the edge of everything. Peering through at them, bathed in an incredible white light, is the face of God himself. A brief period of silence followed this. Then the exec said, "It's not big enough. Didn't I just tell you guys to think really big?" In response, Ellison is supposed to have flipped the guy the bird, the Cord Wayner Bird, one assumes, and walked out. Here is Harlan Ellison's recitation of the true facts. Paramount had been trying to get a Star Trek film in work for some time. Roddenberry was determined that his name would be on the writing credit somehow. The trouble is, he can't write for sour owl poop. His one idea, done 6 or 7 times in the series and again in the feature film, is that the crew of the Enterprise goes into deepest space, finds God, and God turns out to be insane, or a child, or both. I'd been called in twice, prior to 1975, to discuss the story. Other writers had also been milked. Paramount couldn't make up their minds and had even kicked Gene off the project a few times, until he brought in lawyers. Then the palace guard changed again at Paramount, and Diller and Eisner came over from ABC and brought a cadre of their buddies. One of them was an ex-set designer, named Mark Trabulus. Roddenberry suggested me as the scenarist for the film with this Trabulus. The latest of the know-nothing duds Paramount had assigned to the troublesome project. I had a talk with Gene about a storyline. He told me they kept wanting bigger and bigger stories, and no matter what was suggested, it wasn't big enough. I devised a storyline, and Gene liked it, and set up a meeting with Trabulus for 11 December 1975. That meeting was canceled, but we finally got together on 15 December. It was just Gene Roddenberry and Trabulus and me in Gene's office on the Paramount lot. I told them the story. It involved going to the end of the known universe to slip back through time to the Pleistocene period when man first emerged. I postulated a parallel development of reptile life that might have developed into the dominant species on Earth had not mammals prevailed. I postulated an alien intelligence from a far galaxy where the snakes had become the dominant life form, and a snake creature who had come to Earth in the Star Trek future had seen its ancestors wiped out, and who had gone back into the far past of Earth to set up distortions in the time flow so the reptiles could beat the humans. The Enterprise goes back to set time right, finds the snake alien, and the human crew is confronted with a moral dilemma of whether it had the right to wipe out an entire life form just to ensure its own territorial imperative in our present and future. The story, in short, spanned all of time and all of space with a moral and ethical problem. Trabulus listened to all this and sat silently for a few minutes. Then he said, "You know, I was reading this book by a guy named Von Daniken, and he proved that the Maya calendar was exactly like ours, so it must have come from aliens. Could you put in some Mayans?" I looked at Gene. Gene looked at me. He said nothing. I looked at Trabulus and said, "There weren't any Mayans at the dawn of time." And he said, "Well, who's to know the difference?" And I said, "I'm to know the difference. It's a dumb suggestion." So Trabulus got very uptight and said he liked Mayans a lot, and why didn't I do it if I wanted to write this picture? So I said, "I am a writer. I don't know what the fuck you are." And I got up and walked out. And that was the end of my association with the Star Trek movie. Which leaves the rest of us mortals, who can never find exactly the right word at exactly the right time, with nothing to say but, "Right on, Harlan." At the same time he was writing these scripts for television and winning an unprecedented 3 Writers Guild of America awards for best dramatic television scripts in the process, Ellison was engaging in a bitter running battle, a kind of creative guerrilla warfare with other TV producers over what he regarded as a deliberate effort to degrade his work and to degrade the medium itself, to Cuisinart it, in Ellison's own words. In cases where he felt his work had become so watered down that he no longer wanted his name on the credits, he would substitute the name of Cordwainer Bird, a name that comes up again in the New York Review of Bird, in Strange Wine, a madly amusing story that might well be subtitled The Chicago Seven Visit Brentano's. Cordwainer is an archaic English word for shoemaker. So the literal meaning of Ellison's pen name for scripts, which he feels have been perverted beyond any kind of useful life, is one who makes shoes for birds. It is, I think, as good an explanation as any for the work that television is engaged in, and suggests quite well the nature of its usefulness. It is not the purpose of this book to talk about people per se, nor is it the purpose of this chapter on horror fiction to fulfill a personal glimpse of the writer sort of function. That is the job of the out-of-the-pages section in People magazine, which my youngest son, with unknowing critical acuity, insists on calling Pimple. But in the case of Harlan Ellison, the man and his work have become so entwined that it is impossible to pull them completely apart. The book I want to talk about here is Ellison's collection of short fiction, Strange Wine, 1978. But each Ellison collection seems built on the collections which have preceded it. Each seems to be Ellison's report to the outside world on the subject, "This is where Harlan is now." And so it becomes necessary to discuss this book in a more personal way. He demands it of himself, and while that doesn't specially matter, his work also demands it, and that does matter. Ellison's fiction is, and always has been, a nervous bundle of contradictions. He's not a novelist, he says, but he has written at least 2 novels, and one of them, Rockabilly, later retitled Spider Kiss, remains one of the two or three best novels ever to be published about the cannibalistic world of rock and roll music. He says he's not a fantasist, but nearly all of his stories are fantasies. In the course of Strange Wine, for instance, we meet a writer whose work is done for him by gremlins, after the writer himself has gone dry. We also meet a nice Jewish boy who was haunted by his mother after she dies.
"Mom, why don't you get off my case?"
Lance, the nice Jewish boy in question, asks the ghost desperately at one point.
"I saw you playing with yourself last night."
The shade of Mom returns sadly. In the introduction to the book's most frightening story, Croatoan, Ellison says he is pro-choice when it comes to abortion, just as he has said in both his fiction and in his essays over the last 20 years that he is an affirmed liberal and free thinker. Ellison anecdote number 2. My wife and I attended the lecture that Harlan gave at the University of Colorado in the fall of 1974. He had, at that time, just finished Croatoan, The Skin Freezer, which leads off Strange Wine, and he'd had a vasectomy 2 days before. "I'm still bleeding," he told the audience, "and my lady can attest that I'm telling the truth." The lady did so attest, and an elderly couple began to make their way out of the auditorium looking a bit shocked. Harlan waved a cheery goodbye to them from the podium. "Night, folks," he called. "Sorry it wasn't what you wanted." But Croatoan, and most of Ellison's short stories, are as sternly moralistic as the words of an Old Testament prophet. In many of the out-and-out horror tales, there is more than a whiff of those tales from the vault of horror ghastlies, where the climax so often involves the evildoer having his crimes revisited upon himself, only raised to the 10th power. But the irony cuts with a keener blade in Ellison's work, and we have less feeling that rough justice has been meted out and the balance restored. In Ellison's stories, we have little sense of winners and losers. Sometimes there are survivors. Sometimes there are no survivors. Croatoan uses that myth of alligators under the streets of New York as its starting point. See also Thomas Pynchon's V, and a funny horrible novel called Death Tour by David J. Michael. This is an oddly pervasive urban nightmare. But Ellison's story is really about abortion. He may not be anti-abortion. Nowhere in his intro to this story does he say he's pro-abortion, however. But the story is certainly more sharply honed and unsettling than that tattered piece of yellow journalism which all right-to-lifers apparently keep in their wallets or purses so they can wave it under your nose at the drop of an opinion. This is the one which purports to have been written by a baby while in utero.
"I can't wait to see the sun and the flowers,"
the fetus gushes.
"I can't wait to see my mother's face smiling down at me."
It ends, of course, with the fetus saying,
"Last night my mother killed me."
Croatoan begins with the protagonist flushing the aborted fetus down the toilet. The ladies who have done the deed to the protagonist's girlfriend have packed their D&C tools and left. Carol, the woman who has had the abortion, flips out and demands that the protagonist go and find the fetus. Trying to placate her, he goes out into the street with a crowbar, levers up a manhole cover, and descends into a different world. The alligator story began, of course, as a result of the "give a kid a baby alligator, aren't they just the cutest little things?" craze of the mid-50s. The kid who got the gator would keep it for a few weeks. Then the tiny alligator would all of a sudden not be so tiny anymore. It would nip, perhaps draw blood, and down the toilet it went. It was not so far-fetched to believe that they might all be down there on the black underside of our society, feeding, growing bigger, waiting to gobble up the first unwary sewer repairman to come sloshing along in his hip waders. As David Michael points out in Death Tour, the problem is that most sewers are much too cold to sustain life in fully grown alligators, let alone in those still small enough to flush away. Such a dull fact, however, is hardly enough to kill such a powerful image. And I understand that a movie which takes this image as its text is on the way. Ellison has always been a sociological sort of writer, and we can almost feel him seizing upon the symbolic possibilities of such an idea, and when the protagonist descends deep enough into this purgatorial world, he discovers a mystery of cryptic Lovecraftian proportions. At the entrance of their land, someone, not the children, they couldn't have done it, long ago built a road sign. It is a rotted log on which has been placed, carved from fine cherry wood, a book and a hand. The book is open, and the hand rests on the book, one finger touching the single word carved in the open pages. The word is Croatoan. Further along, the secret is revealed. Like the alligators of the myth, the fetuses have not died. The sin is not so easily gotten rid of. Used to swimming in placental waters, in their own way as primitive and reptilian as alligators themselves, the fetuses have survived the flush and live here in the dark, symbolically existing in the filth and the shit dropped down on them from the society of our overworld. They are the embodiment of such Old Testament maxims as, "Sin never dies," and "Be sure your sin will find you out." Down here in this land beneath the city live the children. They live easily and in strange ways. I am only now coming to know the incredible manner of their existence. How they eat, what they eat, how they manage to survive, and have managed for hundreds of years. These are all things I learn day by day, with wonder surmounting wonder. I am the only adult here. They have been waiting for me. They call me Father. At its simplest, Croatoan is a tale of the just revenge. The protagonist is a rotter who has casually impregnated a number of women. The abortion on Carol is not the first one his friends Denise and Joanna have performed for this irresponsible Don Juan, although they swear it will be the last. The just revenge is that he finds his dodged responsibilities have been waiting for him all along, as implacable as the rotting corpse, which so often returned from the dead to hunt down its killer in the archetypical Haunt of Fear story. The Graham Ingalls classic, Horror We? How's Bayou? For instance. But Ellison's prose style is arresting. His grasp of this myth image of the lost alligators seems solid and complete, and his evocation of this unsuspected underworld is marvelous. Most of all, we sense outrage and anger. As with the best Ellison stories, we sense personal involvement, and have a feeling that Ellison is not so much telling the tale as he is jabbing it viciously out of its hiding place. It is the feeling that we are walking over a lot of jagged glass in thin shoes, or running across a minefield in the company of a lunatic. Accompanying these feelings is the feeling that Ellison is preaching to us, not in any lackluster ho-hum way, but in a large, bellowing voice that may make us think of Jonathan Edwards' Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. His best stories seem strong enough to contain morals as well as themes, and the most surprising and gratifying thing about his short fiction is that he gets away with the moralizing. We find he rarely sells his birthright for a plot of message. It should not be so, but in his fury, Ellison manages to carry everything, not at a stagger, but at a sprint. In Hitler Painted Roses, we have Margaret Thrushwood, whose sufferings make Job's look like a bad case of athlete's foot. In this fantasy, Ellison supposes, much as Stanley Elkin does in The Living End, that the reality we experience in the afterlife depends on politics, namely, on what people back here think of us. Further, it posits a universe where God, a multiple God here, referred to as they, is an image-conscious poseur with no real interest in right or wrong. Margaret's lover, a Mr. Milquetoast veterinarian named Doc Thomas, murders the entire Ramsdell family in 1935 when he discovers that the hypocritical Ramsdell, "I'll have no whores in my house," Ramsdell says when he catches Margaret in the kip with Doc, has been helping himself to a bit of Margaret every now and then. Ramsdell's definition of whore apparently begins when Margaret's sex partner stops being him. Only Margaret survives Doc's berserk rage, and when she is discovered alive by the townspeople, she is immediately assumed guilty, carried to the Ramsdell well, naked, and pitched in. Margaret is sent to hell for the crime she is presumed to have committed, while Doc Thomas, who dies peacefully in his bed 26 years later, goes to heaven. Ellison's vision of heaven also resembles Stanley Elkin's in The Living End. Paradise, Elkin tells us, resembles a small theme park. Ellison sees it as a place where moderate beauty balances off, but just barely, moderate tackiness. There are other similarities. In both cases, good, nay, saintly, people are sent to hell because of what amounts to a clerical error. And in this desperate view of the modern condition, even the gods are existential. The only horror we are spared is a vision of the Almighty in Adidas sneakers with a head tennis racket over his shoulder and a golden Coke spoon around his neck. All of this comes next year, no doubt. Before we leave the comparison entirely, let me point out that while Elkin's novel was heavily, and for the most part favorably, reviewed, Ellison's story, originally published in Penthouse, a magazine not regularly purchased by seekers after literary excellence, is almost unknown. Strange Wine itself is almost unknown, in fact. Most critics ignore fantasy fiction because they don't know what to do with it, unless it is out-and-out allegory. I do not choose to review fantasy, a sometime critic for no less an organ than the New York Times Book Review once told me. I have no interest in the hallucinations of the mad. It's always good to be in contact with such an open mind. It broadens one. Margaret Thrushwood escapes hell through a fluke, and in his heroically overblown description of the auguries which foreshadow this supernatural belch, Ellison has an amusing whack at rewriting Act I of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Humor and horror are the original Chang and Eng of literature, and Ellison knows it. We laugh, but there is still that undercurrent of unease. As the smoldering sun passed the celestial equator going north to south, numberless portents revealed themselves. A two-headed calf was born in Dorset, near the little town of Blandford. Wrecked ships rose from the depths of the Marianas Trench. Everywhere children's eyes grew old and very wise. Over the Indian state of Maharashtra, clouds assumed the shapes of warring armies. Leprous moss quickly grew on the south side of Celtic megaliths, and then died away in minutes. In Greece, the pretty little gillyflowers began to bleed, and the earth around their clusters gave off a putrescent smell. All 16 of the ominous diri, designated by Julius Caesar in the 1st century B.C., including the spilling of salt and wine, stumbling, sneezing, and the creaking of chairs, made themselves apparent. The Aurora Australis appeared to the Maori. A horned horse was seen by Basques as it ran through the streets of Vizcaya. Numberless other auguries. And the doorway to hell opened. The best thing about the passage quoted above is that we can feel Ellison taking off, pleased with the effect and balance of the language, and the particulars described, pushing it, having fun with it. Among those who escape hell during the brief period that the door stands open are Jack the Ripper, Caligula, Charlotte Corday, Edward Teach, Beard still bristling but with the ribbons therein charred and colorless, laughing hideously, Burke and Hare, and George Armstrong Custer. All are sucked back except for Ellison's Lizzie Borden look-alike, Margaret Thrushwood. She makes her way to heaven, confronts Doc, and is sent back by God when a realization of the hypocrisy at work causes heaven to begin cracking and peeling around the edges. The pool of water Doc is soaking his feet in when Margaret drags her blackened, blistered body over to him begins to fill up with lava. Margaret returns to hell, realizing that she can take it, while poor Doc, who she still manages somehow to love, could not. There are some people who just shouldn't be allowed to fool around with love, she tells God in the story's best line. Hitler, meanwhile, is still painting his roses just inside the portal to hell. He has been too absorbed to even think about escape when the door opened. God takes one look, Ellison tells us, and could not wait to get back to find Michelangelo, to tell him about the grandeur they had beheld there in that most unlikely of places. The grandeur Ellison wants us to see, of course, is not Hitler's roses, but Margaret's ability to love and to go on believing, if only in herself, in a world where the innocent are punished and the guilty rewarded. As in most of Ellison's fiction, the horror revolves around some smelly injustice. Its antidote lies most frequently in the human ability of his protagonists to surmount the unfair situation, or, lacking that, at least to reach a modus vivendi with it. Most of these stories are fables, an uneasy word in a period of literature where the concept of literature is seen to be a simplistic one, and Ellison uses the word frankly in several of his introductions to individual stories. In a letter to me, dated December 28, 1979, he discusses the use of the fable in fantasy fiction that has been deliberately laid against the backdrop of the modern world. "Strange Wine continues, as I see it in retrospect, my perception that reality and fantasy have exchanged positions in contemporary society. If there is a unified theme in the stories, it is that. Continued from the work I have done in the previous two books, Approaching Oblivion 1974 and Deathbird Stories 1975, it tries to provide a kind of superimposed pre-continuum by the use and understanding of which the reader who leads even a lightly examined existence can grasp hold of his/her life and transcend his/her fate by understanding it. That's all pretty high-flown stuff, but what I mean, simply put, is that the workaday events that command our attention are so big, so fantastic, so improbable, that no one who isn't walking the parapet of madness can cope with what's coming down." Which reminds me of something that happened at the 1979 World Fantasy Convention. A UPI reporter asked me the eternal question, "Why do people read this horror stuff?" My reply was essentially Harlan's, "You try to catch the madness in a bell jar so you can cope with it a little better. People who read horror fiction are warped," I told the reporter. "But if you don't have a few warps in your record, you're going to find it impossible to cope with life in the last quarter of the 20th century." The headline of the UPI squib that came down the wire and into newspapers coast to coast was predictable enough, I suppose, and exactly what I deserved for presuming to speak metaphorically to a newspaper man. "King says his fans are warped." Open mouth, insert foot, close mouth. The Tehran hostages, the Patty Hearst kidnapping, the Howard Hughes fake biography and subsequent death, the Entebbe raid, the murder of Kitty Genovese, the Jonestown massacre, the H-bomb alert in Los Angeles several years ago, Watergate, the Hillside Strangler, the Manson family, the oil conspiracy, all of them are melodramatic and excessive beyond the ability of a writer of mimetic fiction to capture in fiction without being ridiculous. Yet all of them happened. If you or I were to attempt writing a novel about such things, before the fact, we'd be laughed out of the critical esteem of even the lowliest reviewer. I'm not paraphrasing the old saw that truth is stranger than fiction, because I don't see any of these events as mirroring truth or reality. 20 years ago, the very idea of international terrorism would have been inconceivable. Today, it's a given. So commonplace that we're unmanned and helpless in the face of Khomeini's audacity. In one fell swoop, the man has become the most important public figure of our time. In short, he has manipulated reality simply by being bold. How precise a paradigm he has become for the copelessness of our times. In this madman we have an example of one who understands, even if subcutaneously, that the real world is infinitely manipulable. He has dreamed and forced the rest of the world to live in that dream. That it is a nightmare for the rest of us is of no concern to the dreamer. One man's utopia. But his example, I suppose, in Cathexian terms, is endlessly replicable. And what he has done is what I try to do in my stories, to alter everyday existence in a stretch of fiction. And by the altering, by an insertion of a paradigmatic fantasy element, to permit the reader to perceive what he takes for granted in the surrounding precept in a slightly altered way. My hope is that the frisson, the tiny shock of new awareness, the little spark of seeing the accepted from an uncomfortable angle, will convince them that there is room enough and time enough, if only one has courage enough, to alter one's existence. My message is always the same. We are the finest, most ingenious, potentially the most godlike construct the universe has ever created, and every man or woman has the ability within him or her to reorder the perceived universe to his or her own design. My stories all speak of courage and ethic and friendship and toughness. Sometimes they do it with love, sometimes with violence, sometimes with pain or sorrow or joy, but they all present the same message. The more you know, the more you can do. Or, as Pasteur put it, chance favors the prepared mind. I am anti-entropy. My work is foursquare for chaos. I spend my life personally and my work professionally keeping the soup boiling. Gadfly is what they call you when you are no longer dangerous. I much prefer troublemaker, malcontent, desperado. I see myself as a combination of Zorro and Jiminy Cricket. My stories go out from here and raise hell. From time to time, some denigrator or critic with umbrage will save my work. He only wrote that to shock. I smile and nod. Precisely. So we find that Ellison's effort to see the world through a glass of fantasy is not really much different from Kurt Vonnegut's efforts to see it through a glass of satire, semi-science fiction, and a kind of existential vapidity. Hi-ho, so it goes. How about that? Or Heller's efforts to see it as an endless tragicomedy played out in an open-air madhouse, or Pynchon's effort to see it as the longest-running absurdist play in creation. The epigram heading the second section of Gravity's Rainbow is from The Wizard of Oz. I don't think we're in Kansas anymore, Toto. And I think that Harlan Ellison would agree that this sums up post-war life in America as well as anything else. The essential similarity of these writers is that they are all writing fables. In spite of varying styles and points of view, the point in all cases is that these are moral tales. In the late 50s, Richard Matheson wrote a terrifying and utterly convincing tale of a modern-day succubus, a female sexual vampire. In terms of shock and effect, it is one of the best tales I've ever read. There is also a succubus tale in Strange Wine, but in Lonely Women Are the Vessels of Time, the succubus is more than a sexual vampire. She is an agent of moral forces, come to set things back in balance by stealing the self-confidence of a wretched man who likes to pick up lonely women in singles bars because they're easy lays. She exchanges her own loneliness for Mitch's potency, and when the sexual encounter is done, she tells him, "Get up and get dressed and get out of here." The story cannot even be described as sociological, although it has a patina of sociology. It is a moral tale, pure and simple. In Emissary from Hamelin, a child piper returns on the 700th anniversary of the abduction of the children from that medieval town and pipes "Fini" for all of mankind. Here Ellison's basic idea that progress is progressing in an immoral way seems a bit shrill and tiresome. An unsurprising mating of the Twilight Zone moral stance with that of the Woodstock Nation. We can almost hear PA systems blaring, "And don't forget to pick up the garbage!" The child's explanation for his return is simple and direct. "We want everyone to stop what they are doing to make this a bad place, or we will take this place away from you." But the words Ellison puts into his newspaper man narrator's mouth to amplify the thought smacks a little bit too much of Woodsy Al for me. "Stop paving over the green lands with plastic. Stop fighting. Stop killing friendship. Have courage. Don't lie. Stop brutalizing each other." These are Ellison's own thoughts, and fine thoughts they are, but I like my stories without billboards. I suppose this sort of misstep, a story with a commercial embedded in its center, is the risk that all fable fiction runs. And perhaps the writer of short stories runs a higher risk of falling into the pit than the novelist, although when a novel falls into this pit, the results are even more awful. Go down to your local library sometimes, get a stack permit, and look up some of the reporter Tom Wicker's novels from the 50s and 60s. Your hair will turn white. In most cases, Ellison goes around the pit, jumps over it, or jumps right into it on purpose, avoiding major injury either by his own talent, the grace of God, or a combination of the two. Some of the stories in Strange Wine don't fit so comfortably into the fable category, and Ellison is perhaps at his best when he is simply goofing with the language, not playing whole songs, but simply producing runs of melody and feeling. From A to Z in the chocolate alphabet is such a story, except it is not really a story at all. It is a series of fragments, some narrative, some not, that reads more like beat poetry. It was written in the window of the Change of Hobbit bookstore in Los Angeles, under circumstances so confusing that Ellison's introduction to the piece does not even really do it justice. The individual pieces produce individual little ripples of feeling, as good short poems do, and reveal an inspired playfulness with the language that is as good a place to conclude all this as anywhere else, I suppose. Language is play to most writers. Thoughts are play. Stories are fun, the equivalent of a child's tug-me-push-me car that makes such an entrancing sound when you roll it across the floor. So, to close, from A to Z in the chocolate alphabet, Harlan Ellison's version of the sound of one hand clapping, a sound which only the best fantasy horror fiction can provide, and set against it a little something from the work of Clark Ashton Smith, contemporary of Lovecraft and something much closer to a true poet than Lovecraft could ever hope to be. Although Lovecraft desperately wanted to be a poet, I think the best we can say about his poetry is that he was a competent enough versifier, and no one would ever mistake one of his moody staves for the work of Rod McEwen. George F. Haas, Smith's biographer, suggests that Smith's finest work may have been Ebony and Crystal. And this general reader is inclined to agree, although few readers of modern poetry will find much to like in Smith's conventional treatment of his unconventional subject matter. I suspect, though, that Clark Ashton Smith would have liked what Ellison is doing in From A to Z in the Chocolate Alphabet. Here, preceding two selections from the Ellison piece, is a selection from Smith's idea notebook, published by Arkham House 2 years ago as The Black Book of Clark Ashton Smith. The Face from Infinity. A man who fears the sky for some indefinable reason and tries to avoid the open as much as possible. Dying at last in a room with short curtained windows, he finds himself suddenly on a vast bare plain beneath a void heaven. Into this heaven, slowly, there arises a dreadful infinite face from which he can find no refuge, since all his senses have apparently been merged in the one sense of sight. Death, for him, is the eternal moment in which he confronts the face, and knows why he has always feared the sky. Now, the ominous jocularity of Harlan Ellison. He is for elevator people. They never speak, and they cannot meet your gaze. There are 500 buildings in the United States whose elevators go deeper than the basement. When you have pressed the basement button and reached the bottom, you must press the basement button twice more. The elevator doors will close, and you will hear the sound of special relays being thrown, and the elevator will descend into the caverns. Chance has not looked favorably on occasional voyagers in those 500 cages. They have pressed the wrong button too many times. They have been seized by those who shuffle through the caverns, and they have been treated. Now they ride the cages. They never speak, and they cannot meet your gaze. They stare up at the numbers as they light, and then go off, riding up and down even after night has fallen. Their clothes are clean. There is a special dry cleaner who does the work. Once you saw one of them, and her eyes were filled with screams. London is a city filled with narrow, secure stairways. And finally, H is for hamadryad. The Oxford English Dictionary has three definitions of hamadryad. The first is a wood nymph that lives and dies in her tree. The second is a venomous hooded serpent of India. The third definition is improbable. None of them mentions the mythic origins of the word. The tree in which the serpent lived was the hamadryad. Eve was poisoned. The wood of which the cross was made was the hamadryad. Jesus did not rise. He never died. The ark was composed of cubits of lumber cut from the Hamadryad. You will find no sign of the vessel on top of Mount Ararat. It sank. Toothpicks in Chinese restaurants should be avoided at all costs. So now, tell me, did you hear it? The sound of one hand clapping in thin air? 10. I began this chapter, 124 manuscript pages and 2 months ago, by saying that it would be impossible to effect an overview of horror fiction during the last 30 years without writing a whole book on the subject, and that is as true now as it was 2 months and all those pages ago. All I've been able to do here is to mention some books in the genre that I like, and hopefully draw short arrows in the direction these novels and stories seem to point. I haven't discussed I Am Legend, but if you should be intrigued enough to read The Shrinking Man as a result of what I've said here, you'll probably get to it and find Matheson's unmistakable trademarks on that book as well. His interest in restricting character to a single person under pressure, so that character can be fully examined. His emphasis on courage in adversity. His mastery of terror against what appears to be a normal, everyday backdrop. I haven't discussed the work of Roald Dahl or John Collier or Jorge Luis Borges, but if you exhaust Harlan Ellison's current stock of offbeat, jivey fantasy, you will find these others, and in them you will find many of Ellison's interests repeated, particularly his examination of man at his worst, most venal, and his best, most courageous and true. To read Ann Rivers Siddon's novel of domicile possession may lead you to my novel on the same subject, The Shining, or Robert Marasco's brilliant Burnt Offerings. But a few short arrows is all I can possibly draw. To enter the world of horror fiction is to venture, small as a hobbit, through certain mountain passes, where the only trees which will grow are undoubtedly hamadryads, and into the equivalent of the land of Mordor. This is the fuming volcanic country of the Dark Lord, and if the critics who have seen it firsthand are few, the cartographers are fewer. This land is mostly white space on the map, which is how it should be. I'll leave more detailed map-making to those graduate students and English teachers who feel that every goose which lays gold must be dissected so that all of its quite ordinary guts can be labeled. To those figurative engineers of the imagination who cannot feel comfortable with the comfortably overgrown and possibly dangerous literary wilderness until they have built a freeway composed of Cliff's Notes through it. And listen to me, you people. Every English teacher who ever did a Monarch or Cliff's Notes ought to be dragged out of his or her quad, drawn and quartered, then cut up into tiny pieces, set pieces to be dried and shrunk in the sun, and then sold in the college bookstore as bookmarks. I'll leave the longer arrows to those pharmacists of creativity who cannot feel totally at ease until each tale, created to hold some reader spellbound, as each of us was at one time held spellbound by the story of Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood, or The Hook, has been neatly dehydrated and poured into a gel capsule to be swallowed. That is their job, the job of dissectors, engineers, and pharmacists, and I leave it to them, along with a fervent wish that Shelob may catch them and eat them as they enter the Dark Lord's land, or that the faces in the Marsh of the Dead will first hypnotize them and then drive them mad by quoting Cleanth Brooks to them eternally in mud-choked voices, or that the Dark Lord himself will take them up to his tower forever, or cast them into the cracks of doom, where crocodiles of living obsidian wait to crunch up their bodies and silence their quacking, droning voices forever. And if they avoid all that, I hope they catch poison oak. My job is done, I think. My grandfather told me once that the best map is one that points to which way is north and shows you how much water is in your way. That's the sort of map I've tried to provide here. Literary criticism and rhetoric aren't forms I'm comfortable with, but I'd just as soon talk books for 2 months at a time is the way it looks. Somewhere in the middle of Alice's restaurant, Arlo Guthrie tells his audience, "I could play all night. I'm not proud or tired." I could say much the same thing. I haven't talked about Charles Grant's Ox Run Station books or Manly Wade Wellman's Appalachian Bard, John. he of the silver-stringed guitar. I've had only a chance to touch briefly on Fritz Lieber's Our Lady of Darkness. But, gentle reader, there is a pale brown thing in that book that will haunt your dreams. There are dozens of others. No, I take that back. There are hundreds. Chapter 10. The Last Waltz. Horror and Morality. Horror and Magic. 1. Yes, but how do you justify earning a living by feeding off people's worst fears? 2. The police have been summoned by a neighbor who has heard a commotion of some kind. What they find is a bloodbath and something worse. The young man admits, quite calmly, that he has murdered his grandmother with a pipe and then cut her throat. I needed her blood, the young man tells the police calmly. I'm a vampire. Without her blood, I would have died. In his room, the police find magazine articles about vampires, vampire comic books, stories, novels. 3. We've been having a pretty nice lunch, this reporter from the Washington Post and I, something I was grateful for. I had just started a 12-city tour for my novel, The Dead Zone, the day before in New York, with a kickoff party thrown by the Viking Press at Tavern on the Green, a huge, rococo eating and drinking establishment on the edge of Central Park. I had tried to take it easy at the party, but I still managed to put away about 8 beers there and another 6 or so at a smaller, more relaxed party with some friends from Maine later on. Nevertheless, I was up the next morning at 4:45 to make the 6 o'clock Eastern shuttle to Washington, so I could, in turn, make a 7 o'clock TV appearance to plug my novel. Welcome to touring, friends and neighbors. I made the shuttle handily, telling invisible beads as it took off in a pouring rainstorm, sitting next to an overweight businessman who read the Wall Street Journal through the entire flight and ate Tums, one after another, deliberately and reflectively, as if enjoying them. It made A.M. Washington with at least 10 minutes to spare. The television lights intensified the mild hangover I'd gotten up with, and I was grateful for what had been a fairly laid-back lunch with the Post reporter, whose questions had been interesting and relatively unthreatening. Then this spitball about feeding off people's fears comes out of nowhere. The reporter, a young, lanky guy, was looking at me over his sandwich, eyes bright. 4. It's 1960, and a lonely Ohio youth has left the movie theater where he has just seen Psycho for the 5th time. This young man goes home and stabs his grandmother to death. The pathologist would later count over 40 separate stab wounds. Why? The police asked. Voices, the young man replies. Voices told me to do it. 5. Look, I said, putting my own sandwich down. You take any big city psychiatrist. He's got a marvelous home in the suburbs, $100,000 worth of house at the very least. He drives a Mercedes-Benz, either tobacco brown or silver gray. His wife has got a country squire wagon. His kids go to private schools during the academic year and to good summer camps in New England or in the Northwest every summer. Sonny has got Harvard if he can make the grades. Money is certainly no problem. And his daughter can go to some reet-and-complete girls' school where the sorority motto is, "We don't conjugate, we decline." And how is he making the money that produces all of these wonders? He is listening to women weep over their frigidity. He is listening to men with suicidal impulses. He is dealing with paranoia both high and low. He's maybe striking on the occasional true schizophrenic. He's dealing with people who most of all are scared shitless that their lives have somehow gotten out of control and that things are falling apart. And if that isn't earning a living by feeding off people's fears, I don't know what is. I picked up my sandwich again and bit into it, convinced that if I hadn't hit the spitter he had thrown me, I'd at least manage to foul it back and stay alive at the plate. When I looked up from my Reuben, the little half-smile on the reporter's face was gone.
I, he said softly, happen to be in analysis.
6. January of 1980. The woman and her mother are having a worried conference over the woman's 3-month-old baby. The baby won't stop crying. It always cries. They agree on the source of the problem. The baby has been possessed by a demon, like that little girl in The Exorcist. They pour gasoline on the baby as it lies crying in its crib, and then light the child on fire to drive the demon out. The baby lingers in a burn ward for 3 days. Then it dies. 7. The reporter's article was clean and fair for all of that. He was unkind about my physical appearance, and I suppose he had some cause. I was in the slobbiest shape I'd been in for 10 years during that late summer of 1979, but other than that, I felt I got a pretty square shake. But even in the piece he wrote, you can feel the place where his path and mine diverged. There is that quiet snap, which is the sound of ideas suddenly going off in 2 completely different directions. "You get the impression that King likes this sort of sparring," he wrote. 8. Boston, 1977. A woman is killed by a young man who uses a number of kitchen implements to effect the murder. Police speculate that he might have gotten the idea from a movie, Brian De Palma's Carrie, from the novel by Stephen King. In the film version, Carrie kills her mother by causing all sorts of kitchen implements, including a corkscrew and a potato peeler, to fly across the room and literally nail the woman to the wall. 9. Primetime television survived the call by pressure groups to end the excessive graphic depiction of violence on the tube for over 10 years, and House and Senate subcommittees almost without number which were convened to discuss the subject. Private eyes went on shooting bad guys and getting clopped over the head after the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King. You could order up a dose of carnage at the twist of the channel selector on any night of the week, including Sundays. The undeclared war in Vietnam was heating up quite nicely, thank you. Body counts were spiraling into the stratosphere. Child psychologists testified that after watching 2 hours of violent primetime TV, groups of children in the test group showed a marked increase in play aggressiveness, beating the toy truck against the floor rather than rolling it back and forth, for instance. 10. Los Angeles, 1969. Janis Joplin, who will later die of a drug overdose, is belting out Ball and Chain. Jim Morrison, who will die of a heart attack in a bathtub, is chanting "Kill, kill, kill, kill" at the end of a song titled The End. Francis Ford Coppola will use the song 10 years later to fade in the prologue of Apocalypse Now. Newsweek publishes a picture of a shyly smiling U.S. soldier holding up a severed human ear. And in a Los Angeles suburb, a young boy puts out his brother's eyes with his fingers. He was, he explained, only trying to imitate the old Three Stooges two-fingered boing. When they do it on TV, the weeping child explains, no one gets hurt. 11. Television's make-believe violence rolled on nevertheless through the 60s, past Charles Whitman up on the Texas Tower. There was a rumor about a tumor, Kinky Friedman and the Texas Jew Boys sang gleefully, nestled at the base of his brain. And what finally killed it and ushered in the sitcom 70s was a seemingly unimportant event when compared to the deaths of a president, a senator, a great civil rights leader. Television execs were finally forced to rethink their position because a young girl ran out of gas in Roxbury. She had a gas can in her trunk, unfortunately. She got it filled at a gas station, and while walking back to her beached car, she was set upon by a gang of black youths who took her gas can away from her, doused her with the gas, and then, like the woman and her mother trying to drive the demon out of the baby, lit her on fire. Days later, she died. The youths were caught, and someone finally asked them the $64 question, "Where did you get such a horrible idea?" "From TV," came the response. "From the ABC movie of the week." Near the end of the 60s, Ed McBain, in reality novelist Evan Hunter, wrote one of his finest 87th Precinct novels of the policeman's lot. It was called Fuzz, and dealt in part with a gang of teenagers who went around dousing winos with gasoline and lighting them up. The film version, which is described by Stephen Scheuer in his invaluable tube-side companion Movies on TV as a scatterbrained comedy starring Burt Reynolds and Raquel Welch. The biggest yucks in the movie came when several cops on stakeout dress up as nuns and then chase after a suspect holding their habits up to reveal big, clunky work shoes.
Pretty funny, right, gang? A real gut-buster.
McBain's novel isn't a gut-buster. It's grim and almost beautiful. Certainly he has never come any closer to defining exactly what the policeman's lot may be than near the end of the novel when Steve Cardella, masquerading as a wino, is lit on fire himself. The producers of the movie apparently saw something between MASH and Naked City in this, and the misbegotten result is in most respects as forgettable as a Tracy Stallard fastball, except that one of Stallard's fastballs went out of Fenway Park to become Roger Maris's record-breaking 61st home run, and Fuzz, a poorly executed comedy drama, effectively ended TV violence. The message? You are responsible. And network TV accepted the message. 12. How do you justify the violence of the shower scene in Psycho? A critic once asked Sir Alfred Hitchcock. How do you justify the opening scene in Hiroshima Mon Amour? Hitchcock is reputed to have replied. In that opening scene, which was certainly scandalous by American standards in 1959, we see Emmanuel Riva and Eiji Okada in a naked embrace. The opening scene was necessary to the integrity of the film, the critic answered. So was the shower scene in Psycho, Hitchcock said. 13. What sort of burden does the writer, particularly the writer of horror fiction, have to bear in all of this? Certainly there has never been a writer in the field, with the possible exception of Shirley Jackson, who has not been regarded with more than a degree of critical caution. The morality of horror fiction has been called into question for 100 years. One of the blood-spattered forerunners of Dracula, Varney the Vampire, was referred to as a penny dreadful. Later on, inflation turned the penny dreadfuls into dime dreadfuls. In the 1930s, there were cries that pulps such as Weird Tales and Spicy Stories, which regularly served up lip-smacking S&M covers on which lovely ladies were tied down, always in their small clothes, and menaced by some beastly but identifiably male creature of the night, were ruining the morals of the youth of America. Similarly, in the 50s, the comics industry choked off such outlaw growths as EC's Tales from the Crypt, and instituted a comics code when it became clear that Congress intended to clean their house for them if they would not clean it for themselves. There would be no more tales of dismemberment, corpses come back from the dead, and premature burials, or at least not for the next 10 years. The return was signaled by the unpretentious birth of Creepy, a Warren Group magazine which was a complete throwback to the salad days of Bill Gaines's EC horror comics. Uncle Creepy and his buddy Cousin Eerie, who came along 2 years or so later, were really interchangeable with the old witch and the crypt keeper. Even some of the old artists were back. Joe Orlando, who made his debut as an EC artist, was also represented in the premiere issue of Creepy, if memory serves. I would suggest that there has been a great tendency, particularly when it comes to such popular forms as movies, television, and mainstream fiction, to kill the messenger for the message. I do not now and never have doubted that the youths who burned the lady in Roxbury got the idea from the telecast of Fuzz one Sunday night on ABC. If it had not been shown, stupidity and lack of imagination might well have reduced them to murdering her in some more mundane way. The same holds true with many of the other cases mentioned here. The Danse Macabre is a waltz with death. This is a truth we cannot afford to shy away from. Like the rides in the amusement park which mimic violent death, the tale of horror is a chance to examine what's going on behind doors which we usually keep double locked. Yet the human imagination is not content with locked doors. Somewhere there is another dancing partner, the imagination whispers in the night. A partner in a rotting ball gown. A partner with empty eye sockets. Green mold growing on her elbow-length gloves. Maggots squirming in the thin remains of her hair. To hold such a creature in our arms? Who, you ask me, would be so mad? Well...
You will not want to open this door, Bluebeard tells his wife in that most horrible of all horror stories, because your husband has forbidden it.
But this, of course, only makes her all the more curious, and at last her curiosity is satisfied.
You may go anywhere you wish in the castle,
Count Dracula tells Jonathan Harker,
except where the doors are locked. Where, of course, you will not wish to go.
But Harker goes soon enough. And so do we all. Perhaps we go to the forbidden door or window willingly, because we understand that a time comes when we must go whether we want to or not, and not just to look, but to be pushed through forever. 14. Baltimore, 1980. The woman is reading a book and waiting for her bus to arrive. The demobbed soldier who approaches her is a Vietnam vet, a sometime dope addict. He has a history of mental problems which seem to date from his period of service. The woman has noticed him on the bus before, sometimes weaving, sometimes staggering, sometimes calling loudly and wildly to people who are not there.
"That's right, Captain,"
she has heard him say.
"That's right, that's right."
He attacks the woman as she waits for her bus. Later, the police will theorize he was after drug money. No matter. He will be just as dead, no matter what he was after. The neighborhood is a tough one. The woman has a knife secreted upon her person. In the struggle, she uses it. When the bus comes, the black ex-soldier lies dying in the gutter. "What were you reading?" a reporter asks her later. She shows him The Stand, by Stephen King. 15. With its disguise of semantics carefully removed and laid aside, with those who criticize the tale of horror, or simply feel uneasy about it and their liking for it, seem to be saying is this: you are selling death and disfigurement and monstrosity. You are trading upon hate and violence, morbidity and loathing. You are just another representative of those forces of chaos which so endanger the world today. You are, in short, immoral. A critic asked George Romero, following the release of Dawn of the Dead, if he felt such a movie, with its scenes of gore, cannibalism, and gaudy pop violence, was a sign of a healthy society. Romero's reply, worthy of the Hitchcock anecdote related earlier, was to ask the critic if he felt the DC-10 engine mount assembly was a healthy thing for society. His response was dismissed as a quibble. You get the impression Romero likes this kind of sparring. I can almost hear the critic thinking, well, let's see if the quibble really is a quibble, and let's go one layer deeper than we have yet gone. The hour has grown late, the last waltz is playing, and if we don't say certain things now, I suppose we never will. I've tried to suggest throughout this book that the horror story beneath its fangs and fright wig is really as conservative as an Illinois Republican in a three-piece pinstriped suit, that its main purpose is to reaffirm the virtues of the norm by showing us what awful things happen to people who venture into taboo lands. Within the framework of most horror tales, we find a moral code so strong it would make a Puritan smile. In the old EC comics, adulterers inevitably came to bad ends, and murderers suffered fates that would make the rack and the boot look like kiddie rides at the carnival. My all-time favorite, he said affectionately. A crazed husband stuffs the hose of an air compressor down his skinny wife's throat and blows her up like a balloon until she bursts.
Fat at last,
he tells her happily, just moments before the pop. But later on, the husband, who is roughly the size of Jackie Gleason, trips a booby trap she has set for him and is squashed to a shadow when a huge safe falls on him. This ingenious reworking of the old story of Jack Spratt and his wife is not only gruesomely funny,
It offers us a delicious example of the Old Testament eye-for-an-eye theory, or, as the Spanish say, revenge is a dish best eaten cold. Modern horror stories are not much different from the morality plays of the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, when we get right down to it. The horror story most generally not only stands four square for the Ten Commandments, it blows them up to tabloid size. We have the comforting knowledge when the lights go down in the theater or when we open the book that the evildoers will almost certainly be punished, and measure will be returned for measure. Further, I've used one pompously academic metaphor, suggesting that the horror tale generally details the outbreak of some Dionysian madness and an Apollonian existence, and that the horror will continue until the Dionysian forces have been repelled and the Apollonian norm restored again. Excluding a powerful, if puzzling, prologue set in Iraq, William Friedkin's film, The Exorcist, actually begins in Georgetown, an Apollonian suburb if ever there was one. In the first scene, Ellen Burstyn is awakened by a crashing, roaring sound in the attic. It sounds like maybe someone let a lion loose up there. It is the first crack in the Apollonian world. Soon everything else will pour through in a nightmare torrent. But this disturbing crack between our normal world and a chaos where demons are allowed to prey on innocent children is finally closed again at the end of the film, when Burstyn leads the pallid, but obviously okay, Linda Blair to the car in the film's final scene, we understand that the nightmare is over. Steady state has been restored. We have watched for the mutant and repulsed it. Equilibrium never felt so good. Those are some of the things we've talked about in this book. But suppose all of that is only a sham and a false front. I don't say that it is, but perhaps, since this is the last dance, we ought to discuss the possibility at least. In our discussion of archetypes, we've had occasion to discuss the werewolf, that fellow who is sometimes hairy and who is sometimes deceptively smooth. Suppose there was a double werewolf. Suppose that the creator of the horror story was, under his/her fright wig and plastic fangs, a Republican in a three-button suit, as we have said. But suppose below that there is a real monster with real fangs and a squirming Medusa tangle of snakes for hair. Suppose it's all a self-serving lie, and that when the creator of horror is finally stripped all the way to his or her core of being, we find not an agent of the norm, but a friend, a capering, gleeful, red-eyed agent of chaos. What about that possibility, friends and neighbors? 16. About 5 years ago, I finished The Shining, took a month off, and then set about writing a new novel, the working title of which was The House on Value Street. It was going to be a Romana Clef about the kidnapping of Patty Hearst, her brainwashing, or her socio-political awakening, depending on your point of view, I guess, her participation in the bank robbery, the shootout at the SLA hideout in Los Angeles. In my book, the hideout was on Value Street, Natch. The fugitive run across the country, the whole ball of wax. It seemed to me to be a highly potent subject, and while I was aware that lots of non-fiction books were sure to be written on the subject, it seemed to me that only a novel might really succeed in explaining all the contradictions. The novelist is, after all, God's liar, and if he does his job well, keeps his head and his courage, he can sometimes find the truth that lives at the center of the lie. Well, I never wrote that book. I gathered my research materials, such as they were to hand. Patty was still at large then, which was another attraction the idea had for me. I could make up my own ending. And then I attacked the novel. I attacked it from one side, and nothing happened. I tried it from another side, and felt it was going pretty well, until I discovered all my characters sounded as if they had just stepped whole and sweaty from the dance marathon in Horace McCoy's They Shoot Horses, Don't They? I tried it in medias res. I tried to imagine it as a stage play, a trick that sometimes works for me when I'm badly stuck. It didn't work this time. In his marvelous novel, The Hair of Harold Rue, Thomas Williams tells us that writing a long work of fiction is like gathering characters together on a great black plain. They stand around the small fire of the writer's invention, warming their hands at the blaze, hoping the fire will grow into a blaze which will provide light as well as heat. But often it goes out, all light is extinguished, and the characters are smothered in black. It's a lovely metaphor for the fiction-making process, but it's not mine. Maybe it's too gentle to be mine. I've always seen the novel as a large black castle to be attacked, a bastion to be taken by force or by trick. The thing about this castle is it appears to be open. It doesn't look buttoned up for siege at all. The drawbridge is down. The gates are open. There are no bowmen on the turrets. Trouble is, there's really only one safe way in. Every other attempt at entry results in sudden annihilation from some hidden source. With my Patty Hearst book, I never found the right way in. And during that entire 6-week period, something else was nagging very quietly at the back of my mind. It was a news story I had read about an accidental CBW spill in Utah. All the bad, nasty bugs got out of their canister and killed a bunch of sheep. But, the news article stated, if the wind had been blowing the other way, the good people of Salt Lake City might have gotten a very nasty surprise. This article called up memories of a novel called Earth Abides by George R. Stewart. In Stewart's book, a plague wipes out most of mankind, and the protagonist, who has been made immune by virtue of a well-timed snake bite, witnesses the ecological changes which the passing of man causes. The first half of Stewart's long book is riveting. The second half is more of an uphill push. Too much ecology, not enough story. We were living in Boulder, Colorado at the time, and I used to listen to the Bible-thumping station which broadcast out of Arvada quite regularly. One day I heard a preacher dilating upon the text, "Once in every generation the plague will fall among them." I liked the sound of the phrase, which sounds like a biblical quotation, but is not, so well that I wrote it down and tacked it over my typewriter. "Once in every generation, the plague will fall among them." This phrase and the story about the CBW spill in Utah and my memories of Stewart's fine book all became entwined in my thoughts about Patty Hearst and the SLA, and one day, while sitting at my typewriter, my eyes traveling back and forth between that creepy homily on the wall to the maddeningly blank sheet of paper in the machine, I wrote, just to write something, "The world comes to an end, but everybody in the SLA is somehow immune. Snake bit them." I looked at that for a while and then typed, "No more gas shortages." That was sort of cheerful in a horrible sort of way. No more people, no more gas lines. Below, "No more gas shortages," I wrote in rapid order, "No more Cold War, no more pollution, no more alligator handbags, no more crime, a season of rest." I liked that last. It sounded like something that should be written down. I underlined it. I sat there for another 15 minutes or so, listening to the Eagles on my little cassette player, and then I wrote, "Donald DeFries is a dark man." I did not mean that DeFries was black. It suddenly occurred to me that, in the photos taken during the bank robbery in which Patty Hearst participated, you could barely see DeFries' face. He was wearing a big badass hat, and what he looked like was mostly guesswork. I wrote, "A dark man with no face," and then glanced up and saw that grisly little motto again, "Once in every generation the plague will fall among them." And that was that. I spent the next 2 years writing an apparently endless book called The Stand. It got to the point where I began describing it to friends as my own little Vietnam, because I kept telling myself that in another 100 pages or so I would begin to see light at the end of the tunnel. The finished manuscript was over 1,200 pages long and weighed 12 pounds, the same weight as the sort of bowling ball I favor. I carried it 30 blocks from the UN Plaza Hotel to my editor's apartment one warm night in July. My wife had wrapped the entire block of pages in saran wrap for some reason known only to her, and after I'd switched it from one arm to the other for the third or fourth time, I had a sudden premonition. I was going to die, right there on Third Avenue. The rescue unit would find me sprawled in the gutter, dead of a heart attack, my monster manuscript
triumphantly encased in saran wrap, resting by my outstretched hands, the victor. There were times when I actively hated the stand, but there was never a time when I did not feel compelled to go on with it. Even when things were going bad with my guys in Boulder, there was a crazy, joyful feeling about the book. I couldn't wait to sit down in front of the typewriter every morning and slip back into that world where Randy Flagg could sometimes become a crow, sometimes a wolf, and where the big battle was not for gasoline allocations but for human souls. There was a feeling, I must admit it, that I was doing a fast, happy tap dance on the grave of the whole world. Its writing came during a troubled period for the world in general, and America in particular. We were suffering from our first gas pains in history. We had just witnessed the sorry end of the Nixon administration and the first presidential resignation in history. We had been resoundingly defeated in Southeast Asia, and we were grappling with a host of domestic problems, from the troubling question of abortion on demand to an inflation rate that was beginning to spiral upward in a positively scary way. Me? I was suffering from a really good case of career jet lag. 4 years before, I had been running sheets in an industrial laundry for $1.60 an hour and riding carry in the furnace room of a trailer. My daughter, who was then almost a year old, was dressed mostly in scrounged clothes. The year before that, I had married my wife Tabitha in a borrowed suit that was too big for me. I left the laundry when a teaching position opened up at a nearby school, Hampton Academy, and my wife Tabby and I were dismayed to learn that my first-year salary of $6,400 was not going to take us much further than my laundry salary, and pretty soon I'd secured my laundry job back for the following summer. Then Carrie sold to Doubleday, and Doubleday sold the reprint rights for a staggering sum of money, which was, in those days, nearly a record-breaker. Life began to move at Concord speed. Carrie was bought for films. Salem's Lot was bought for a huge sum of money and then also bought for films. The Shining, likewise. Suddenly all of my friends thought I was rich. That was bad enough, scary enough. What was worse was the fact that maybe I was. People began to talk to me about investments, about tax shelters, about moving to California. These were changes enough to try and cope with, but on top of them, the America I had grown up in seemed to be crumbling beneath my feet. It began to seem like an elaborate castle of sand, unfortunately built well below the high tide line. The first wave to touch that castle, or the first one that I perceived, was that long-ago announcement that the Russians had beaten us into space. But now, the tide was coming in for fair. And so here, I think, is the face of the double werewolf, revealed at last. On the surface, the stand pretty much conforms to those conventions we have already discussed. An Apollonian society is disrupted by a Dionysian force, in this case a deadly strain of superflu that kills almost everybody. Further, the survivors of this plague discover themselves in two camps. One, located in Boulder, Colorado, mimics the Apollonian society just destroyed, with a few significant changes. The other, located in Las Vegas, Nevada, is violently Dionysian. The first Dionysian incursion in The Exorcist comes when Chris McNeil, Ellen Burstyn, hears that lion-like roar in the attic. In the stand, Dionysus announces himself with the crash of an old Chevy into the pumps of an out-of-the-way gas station in Texas. In The Exorcist, the Apollonian steady state is restored when we see a pallid Regan McNeil being led to her mother's Mercedes-Benz. In the stand, I believe that this moment comes when the book's two main characters, Stu Redman and Franny Goldsmith, look through a plate glass window in the Boulder Hospital at Franny's obviously normal baby. As with The Exorcist, the return of equilibrium never felt so good. But below all of this, hidden by the moral conventions of the horror tale, but perhaps not all that hidden, the face of the real werewolf can be dimly seen. Much of the compulsion I felt while writing The Stand obviously came from envisioning an entire entrenched societal process destroyed at a stroke. I felt a bit like Alexander, lifting his sword over the Gordian knot and growling, "Fuck untying it. I've got a better way." and I felt a bit the way Johnny Rotten sounds at the beginning of that classic and electrifying Sex Pistols song, Anarchy for the UK. He utters a low, throaty chuckle that might have come from Randall Flagg's own throat, and then intones, "Right now!" We hear that voice, and our reaction is one of intense relief. The worst is now known. We are in the hands of an authentic madman. In this frame of mind, the destruction of the world as we know it became an actual relief. No more Ronald McDonald, no more Gong Show or soap on TV, just soothing snow. No more terrorists, no more bullshit. Only the Gordian knot unwinding there in the dust. I am suggesting that below the writer of the moral horror tale, whose feet, like those of Henry Jekyll, are always treading the upward path, there lies another creature altogether. He lives, let us say, down there on Jack Finney's third level, and he is a capering nihilist who, to extend the Jekyll Hyde metaphor, is not content to tread over the tender bones of one screaming little girl, but in this case feels it necessary to do the funky chicken over the whole world. Yes, folks, in the stand I got a chance to scrub the whole human race, and it was fun. So where is morality now? Well, I'll give you my idea. I think it lies where it has always lain, in the hearts and minds of men and women of goodwill. In the case of the writer, this may mean beginning with a nihilistic premise and gradually relearning old lessons of human values and human conduct. In the case of the stand, this meant beginning with the glum premise that the human race carries a kind of germ with it. I began by seeing this germ symbolically visualized in the SLA, and ended by seeing it visualized in the superflu germ, which grows more and more virulent as technology grows in power. The superflu is unleashed by a single technological misstep. Not such a far-fetched presumption either, when you consider what happened at Three Mile Island last year, or the fact that Loring AFB in my own state scrambled bombers and fighters ready to head over the pole toward Russia as the result of an amusing little computer foul-up which suggested that the Russians had launched their missiles and the big hot one was on. By simple agreement with myself to allow a few survivors... No survivors, no stories, am I right? I was able to envision a world in which all the nuclear stockpiles would simply rust away and some kind of normal, moral, political, and ecological balance would return to the mad universe we call home. But I don't think anyone knows what they really think, or perhaps even what they really know until it's written down, and I came to realize that the survivors would be very likely to first take up all the old quarrels and then all the old weapons. Worse, all those deadly toys would be available to them, and things might well become a sprint to see which group of loonies could figure out how to launch them first. My own lesson in writing The Stand was that cutting the Gordian knot simply destroys the riddle instead of solving it, and the book's last line is an admission that the riddle still remains. The book also tries to celebrate brighter aspects of our lives, simple human courage, friendship, and love, in a world which so often seems mostly loveless. In spite of its apocalyptic theme, The Stand is mostly a hopeful book that echoes Albert Camus' remark that happiness, too, is inevitable. More prosaically, my mother used to tell my brother David and me to hope for the best and expect the worst. And that expresses the book I remember writing as well as anything. So, in short, we hope for a fourth level. A triple werewolf? One that will bring us full circle again to the horror writer, not just as writer but as human being, mortal man or woman, just another passenger in the boat, another pilgrim on the way to whatever there is. And we hope that if he sees another pilgrim fall down that he will write about it, but not before he or she has helped the fallen one off his or her feet, brushed off his or her clothes, and seen if he or she is all right and able to go on. If such behavior is to be, it cannot be as a result of an intellectual moral stance. It is because there is such a thing as love, merely a practical fact, a practical force in human affairs. Morality is, after all,
a codification of those things which the heart understands to be true and those things which the heart understands to be the demands of a life lived among others, civilization, in a word. And if we remove the label horror story or fantasy genre or whatever, and replace it with literature or, more simply still, fiction, we may realize more easily that no such blanket accusations of immorality can be made. If we say that morality proceeds simply from a good heart, which has little to do with ridiculous posturings and happily ever afterings, and immorality proceeds from a lack of care, from shoddy observation, and from the prostitution of drama or melodrama for some sort of gain, monetary or otherwise, then we may realize that we have arrived at a critical stance which is both workable and humane. Fiction is the truth inside the lie, and in the tale of horror, as in any other tale, the same rule applies now as when Aristophanes told his horror tale of the frogs. Morality is telling the truth as your heart knows it. When asked if he was not ashamed of the rawness and sordidness of his turn-of-the-century novel McTeague, Frank Norris replied, "Why should I be? I did not lie. I did not truckle. I told them the truth." Seen in that light, I think the horror tale may more often be adjudged innocent than guilty. 17. "My, look at this. I do believe the sun is coming up. We have danced the night away like lovers in some old MGM musical. But now the band has packed their melodies back inside their cases and has quitted the stage. The dancers have left, all but you and I suppose we must go as well. I cannot tell you how much I've enjoyed this evening, and if you sometimes found me a clumsy partner, or if I occasionally stepped on your toes, I do apologize. I feel as I suppose all lovers feel when the dance has finally ended, tired, but still gay. As I walk you to the door, may I tell you one more thing? We'll stand here in the vestibule as they unroll the rug again and douse the lights. Let me help you with your coat. I'll not keep you long." Questions of morality in the pursuit of horror may be begging the actual question. The Russians have a phrase, "the scream of the woodcock." The phrase is derisory because the woodcock is nature's ventriloquist, and if you fire your shotgun at the place where the sound came from, you'll go hungry. Shoot the woodcock, not the scream, the Russians say. So let's see if we can't find a woodcock, just one in all these screaming thickets. It might just be hiding in this item, truth rather than fiction, from the Book of Lists, the Wallace-Wallachinsky clan's attic full of fascinating rickrack and useful junk. As you get ready to leave, think about this, or brood upon it. The Mystery of Little Miss Nobody. On July 6, 1944, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus was giving a performance in Hartford, Connecticut, before 7,000 paid customers. A fire broke out. 168 persons died in the blaze and 487 were injured. One of the dead, a small girl thought to be 6 years old, was unidentified. Since no one came to claim her, and since her face was unmarred, a photograph was taken of her and distributed locally and then throughout the U.S. Days passed, weeks and months passed, but no relative, no playmate, no one in the nation came forward to identify her. She remains unknown to this day. My idea of growing up is that the process consists mainly of developing a good case of mental tunnel vision and a gradual ossification of the imaginative faculty. What about Little Miss Nobody, you ask me? Well, hang on. We'll get there. Children see everything, consider everything. The typical expression of the baby, which is full, dry, and awake, is a wide-eyed goggle at everything. Hello, pleased to meet you, freak to be here. A child has not yet developed the obsessional behavior patterns which we approvingly call good work habits. He or she has not yet internalized the idea that a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. All of that comes later. Children believe in Santa Claus. It's no big deal, just a piece of stored information. They likewise believe in the bogeyman,
the Trix Rabbit, McDonald Land, where hamburgers grow on trees and moderate thievery is approved behavior, witness the lovable Hamburglar, the Tooth Fairy, who takes ivory and leaves silver, all of these things are taken as a matter of course. These are some of the popular myths. There are others which, while more specialized, seem just as outré. Grandpa has gone to live with the angels. The stuff in the middle of the golf ball is the worst poison in the world. Step on a crack, break your mother's back. If you walk through holly bushes, your shadow can get caught, and it will be left there forever, flapping on the sharp leaves. The changes come gradually, as logic and rationalism assert themselves. The child begins to wonder how Santa can be at the Value House, on a downtown corner ringing a bell over a Salvation Army pot, and up at the North Pole generaling his troop of elves all at the same time. The child maybe realizes that although he's stepped on a hell of a lot of cracks, his or her mother's back is yet all right. Age begins to settle into that child's face. "Don't be a baby," he or she is told impatiently. "Your head is always in the clouds." And the kicker, of course, "Aren't you ever going to grow up?" After a while, the song says, Puff the Magic Dragon stopped trundling his way up the Cherry Lane to see his old good buddy Jackie Paper. Wendy and her brothers finally left Peter Pan and the Wild Boys to their fate. No more magic dust, and only an occasional happy thought. But there was always something a little dangerous about Peter Pan, wasn't there? Something just a little too woodsy wild. Something in his eyes that was, well, downright Dionysian. Oh, the gods of childhood are immortal. The big kids don't really sacrifice them. They just pass them on to their bratty kid brothers and kid sisters. It's childhood itself that's mortal. Man is in love and loves what passes. And it's not just Puff and Tink and Peter Pan that are left behind in that rush for the driver's license, the high school and college diploma, in that mostly eager training to achieve good work habits. We have each exiled the Tooth Fairy, or perhaps he exiles us when we are no longer able to provide the product he requires. Murdered Santa Claus, only to reanimate the corpse for our own children. Killed the giant that chased Jack down the beanstalk. And the poor old bogeyman, laughed to death again and again, like Mr. Dark, at the conclusion of Something Wicked This Way Comes. Listen to me now. At 18, or 20, or 21, whatever the legal drinking age may be in your state, getting carded is something of an embarrassment. You have to fumble around for a driver's license, or your state liquor card, or maybe even a photostat of your birth certificate, so you can get a simple, for Christ's sakes, glass of beer. But you let 10 years go past, get so you're looking the big 3-0 right in the eye, and there is something absurdly flattering about getting carded. It means you still look like you might not be old enough to buy a drink over the bar. You still look a little wet behind the ears. You still look young. This got into my head a few years ago when I was at a bar called Benjamin's in Bangor, getting pleasantly loaded. I began to study the faces of entering patrons. The guy standing unobtrusively by the door let this one pass, and that one, and the next one. Then bang! He stopped a guy in a U of M jacket and carded him. And I'll be damned if that guy didn't do a quick fade. The drinking age in Maine was then 18. Booze-related accidents on the highways have since caused the lawmakers to move the age up to 20. And all of those people had looked about 18 to me. So I got up and asked the bouncer how he knew that last guy was underage. He shrugged. "You just know," he said. "It's mostly in their eyes." For weeks after, my hobby was looking at the faces of adults and trying to decide exactly what it was that made them adult faces. The face of a 30-year-old is healthy, unwrinkled, and no bigger than the face of a 17-year-old. Yet you know that's no kid. You know. There seems to be some hidden yet overriding characteristic that makes what we all agree is the adult face. It isn't just the clothes or the stance. It isn't the fact that the 30-year-old is toting a briefcase and the 17-year-old is toting a knapsack. If you put the head of each in one of those carnival cutouts which show the body of a capering sailor or a prize fighter, you could still pick out the adult 10 tries out of 10. I came to believe that the bouncer was right. It's in the eyes. Not something that's there. Something, rather, that has left. Kids are bent. They think around corners. But starting at roughly age 8, when childhood's second great era begins, the kinks begin to straighten out one by one. The boundaries of thought and vision begin to close down to a tunnel as we gear up to get along. At last, unable to grapple to any profit with Never Never Land anymore, we may settle for the minor league version available at the local disco, or for a trip to Disney World one February or March. The imagination is an eye, a marvelous third eye that floats free. As children, that eye sees with 20/20 clarity. As we grow older, its vision begins to dim. And one day, the guy at the door lets you into the bar without asking to see any ID, and that's it for you, Charlie. Your hat is over the windmill. It's in your eyes. Something in your eyes. Check them out in the mirror, and tell me if I'm wrong. The job of the fantasy writer, or the horror writer, is to bust the walls of that tunnel vision wide for a little while, to provide a single powerful spectacle for the third eye. The job of the fantasy horror writer is to make you, for a little while, a child again. And the horror writer himself, herself? Someone else looks at that item about Little Miss Nobody. Told you we'd get back to her, and here she is, still unidentified, as mysterious as the Wolf Boy of Paris, and says, "Jeez, you never can tell, can you?" and goes on to something else. But the fantasist begins to play with it as a child would, speculating about children from other dimensions, about doppelgangers, about God knows what. It's a child's toy, something bright and shiny and strange. Let us pull a lever and see what it does. Let us push it across the floor and see if it goes rum, 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 or whacka, whacka, whacka. Let us turn it over and see if it will magically right itself again. In short, let us have our 40 reigns of frogs and people who have mysteriously burned to death while sitting at home in their easy chairs. Let us have our vampires and our werewolves. Let us have Little Miss Nobody, who perhaps slipped sideways through a crack in reality, only to be trampled to death in the rush from a burning circus tent. And something of this is reflected in the eyes of those who write horror stories. Ray Bradbury has the dreamy eyes of a child. So, behind his thick glasses, does Jack Finney. The same look is in Lovecraft's eyes. They startle with their simple, dark directness, especially in that narrow, pinched, and somehow eternal New England face. Harlan Ellison, in spite of his rapid, jive-talking, shoot-from-the-hip, nervous-nervous mode of conversation, talking with Harlan can sometimes be like talking with an apocalyptic salad master salesman who has just taken 3 large bennies, has those eyes. Every now and then he'll pause, looking away, looking at something else, and you know that it's true. Harlan is bent, and he just thought his way around a corner. Peter Straub, who dresses impeccably and who always seems to project the aura of some big company success, also has that look in his eyes. It is an indefinable look, but it's there. It's the best set of electric trains a boy ever had, Orson Welles once said of making movies. The same can be said of making books and stories. Here is a chance to bust that tunnel vision wide open, bricks flying everywhere, so that, for a moment at least, a dreamscape of wonders and horrors stands forth as clearly and with all the magic reality of the first Ferris wheel you ever saw as a kid, turning and turning against the sky. Someone's dead son is on the late movie. Somewhere a foul man, bogeyman, is slouching through the snowy night with shining yellow eyes. Boys are thundering through autumn leaves on their way home past the library at 4 in the morning, and somewhere else, in some other world, even as I write this,
Frodo and Sam are making their way toward Mordor, where the shadows lie.
I am quite sure of it.
Ready to go?
Fine. I'll just grab my coat.
It's not a dance of death at all. Not really. There is a third level here, as well. It is, at bottom, a dance of dreams. It's a way of awakening the child inside, who never dies, but only sleeps ever more deeply. If the horror story is our rehearsal for death, then its strict moralities make it also a reaffirmation of life and goodwill and simple imagination. Just one more pipeline to the infinite. In his epic poem of a stewardess falling to her death from high above the fields of Kansas, James Dickey suggests a metaphor for the life of the rational being, who must grapple as best he/she can with the fact of his/her own mortality. We fall from womb to tomb, from one blackness and toward another, remembering little of the one and knowing nothing of the other, except through faith. That we retain our sanity in the face of these simple yet blinding mysteries is nearly divine. That we may turn the powerful intuition of our imaginations upon them and regard them in this glass of dreams, that we may, however timidly, place our hands within the hole which opens at the center of the column of truth, that is, well, it's magic, isn't it? Yeah, I think maybe that's what I want to leave you with, in lieu of a goodnight kiss. That word, which children respect instinctively, that word whose truth we only rediscover as adults in our stories and in our dreams. Magic. Afterword. In July of 1977, my wife and I hosted a gathering of my wife's entire family, a giant collection of sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, and millions of kids. My wife spent most of that week cooking, and of course what always happens at family gatherings happened at this one. Everybody brought a casserole. Much food was eaten on the shores of Long Lake that sunny summer day. Many cans of beer were consumed. And when the crowd of Spruces and Atwoods and Labrees and Graveses and everyone else had departed, we were left with enough food to feed an army regiment. So we ate leftovers. Day in, day out, we ate leftovers. And when Tabby brought out the remains of the turkey for the fifth or sixth time, we had eaten turkey soup, turkey surprise, and turkey with noodles. This day was something simpler. Nice, nourishing turkey sandwiches. My son Joe, who was then 5, looked at it and screamed, "Do we have to eat this shit again?" I didn't know whether to laugh or clout him upside the head. As I recall, I did both. I told you that story because people who have read a lot of my work will realize that they have eaten a few leftovers here. I have used material from my introduction to Night Shift, from my introduction to the New American Library's omnibus edition of Frankenstein, Dracula, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, from an article entitled The Fright Report, originally published in We Magazine, from an article called The Third Eye in The Writer. Much of the material on Ramsey Campbell originally appeared in Stuart Schiff's Whispers magazine. Now, before you decide to clout me upside the head or to scream, "Do we have to eat this shit again?" let me point out to you what my wife pointed out to my son on the day of the turkey sandwiches. There are hundreds of different recipes for turkey, but they all taste like turkey. And coupled with that, she said, it is a shame to waste good things. This is not to say that my article in We was so paralyzingly great or that my thoughts on Ramsey Campbell were so deathless that they deserve to be preserved in a book. It is only to say that while my thoughts and feelings on the genre I've spent most of my life working in may have evolved or shifted somewhat in perspective, they haven't really changed. That change may come, but since there has only been a passage of 4 years since I originally stated many of my feelings about horror and terror in the Night Shift introduction, it would be surprising, even suspect, if I were to suddenly deny everything I had written previous to this book. In my own defense, I'll add that Danse Macabre gave me the space to develop some of these ideas in more detail than I had ever been given before, and for that I must thank Bill Thompson and Everest House.
In no case did I simply reheat something I had written before. I tried as hard as I could to develop each idea as fully as possible without beating it into the ground. In some cases I may have done just that, though, and all I can do in such cases is to beg your indulgence. And I think that really is the end. Thank you again for coming with me, and rest you well. But being who I am and what I am, I cannot find it in my heart to wish you pleasant dreams.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Danse Macabre by Stephen King, copyright 1981 by Stephen King, performed by William DeFreeze. Performance copyright 2009 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225. Or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.